was young. It's not my problem. It's not my problem.
WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, Peter. How's it going?
Ready for another Sunday night Night Call?
I am riled up.
Is the Motor City ready?
Well, that's I hope so. Get ready, because here we go.
And via the internet,
hey. WRIF.com.
All around the world.
Yes. Yeah. We're glad you're here.
Well, this is a phone-in talk show, something that WRI has been doing for the last 410 years, right?
I thought it was 411.
Yeah, and we've been with it for the last 270. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. And we have a phone number that gets you on the air. Essentially what we do is pose questions, pose ideas, and you can either comment on them, disagree, agree, extend the conversation. It's your call.
Free literally. Form, man.
Free, yeah, man. Yeah. 313-298-9743, which is?
313-298. Wait, WRIF, you threw me for a loop.
I did.
You took my part.
Yeah. We got a real active Facebook going, thanks to Jolene and to Debbie. And you can go to facebook.com/nightcall. We like likes.
Yes, come on along.
Yeah, and we'll have a podcast available at noon tomorrow, thanks to Athena and Sarah, who are waiting for your calls at 313-298-WRIF. Tons of stuff going on. Obama slipping into Afghanistan,
yep,
saying, hey, everything's ending.
Except, in 3 years.
Yeah. Well, and we're going to leave 20,000 troops.
Right.
But the big news tonight is Francois Hollande, which looks like Holland, except it's pronounced Hollande. I wonder what George Bush would do with that. The man that Francois Hollande defeated, his name was Sarkozy.
Yeah.
And
in France, and he won the
Texas
election.
Yeah, but in Texas, Bush would call him Sarkozy.
Yeah, that's right. I think he did. Remember that?
He did. Yeah.
Sarkozy. It was worse. We can't even say it. It was so bad.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, the Francois Hollande is a Socialist Party candidate. So now he's being called the socialist president of France.
Great.
Well, yeah, but on the other hand, they never called Sarkozy the conservative president of...
That's true.
Yeah. And he was swept into office Sunday. Actually, it was only by a percentage point or two. The first socialist to be elected president of France since François Mitterrand left office in 1995. When Mitterrand died, I don't know why I like this, because, you know, this is nothing like my life, but both his wife and his mistress were at the funeral.
I just think it's kind of fun. It's very French.
Those French, yeah. And Mr. Hollande's campaign promised a kinder, gentler, more inclusive France, but his victory over President Nicolas Sarkozy will also be seen as a challenge to the German-dominated policy of economic austerity in the Eurozone. And if you're thinking, what the hell is that all about and how in the world does that affect me? Well, it could. I mean, for one thing, that the capitalism is not based, as you would think, on us working and buying. I mean, it is to some extent, but mostly it is about companies making profits. And so the people that are the politicians that are kinder and gentler to the big corporations.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. They provide more money to the companies, which then means that the stock market goes up because the companies are worth more.
Yeah. It's really just corporate rule.
Yeah, it's the golden rule. He who has the gold rules.
Yeah, exactly.
And we've been fighting against that for about, common people, the last 1,000 years or so. And every once in a while, we think we got kind of a toehold in there, and we're going to really get a little place in the sun, and we're not going to have to scuffle and worry about our jobs and worry about health care. And then
eat dirt, things like that.
Yeah,
right?
And then, there they come back again.
Just like the cockroaches.
The cockroaches, yeah. Well, Francois Hollande will not do much challenge the way things are run. So the big capitalist need not fear much.
Just like Obama, if you think about it. I mean, people think he's this big socialist. We wish he was way more.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Toward that way. Yeah.
What's the name of David Robick's song? the one.
I wish it were, if only it were true. That's what it's called.
If only it were so.
If only it were true.
So.
True.
Okay. But I'm looking here. I can't remember what I'm looking for. I'm looking at my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E. But, as it turns out, that a lot of these, the rich French, they are here. It says, wealthy French, I move across the channel. And I'm wondering, what does that mean, I move? They're eyeing a move.
I move.
Here's what, this is from the Financial Times. Wealthy French people are looking to London as a refuge from fresh taxes on high earners pledged by candidates in the country's presidential elections.
That's pretty pathetic.
That's like 1789.
That's greed.
You know, all the royalists. Whoa, we got to get our booty out of here.
Right, I mean, come on, please, people.
You want to lose your head over this. Well, they actually did then, didn't they?
Yeah. There was a whole thing with the head getting cut off.
And
Sarkozy, though, he's going to be okay. He's got that hot wife.
Yeah, what's her name?
Model, Carla Bruni.
Carla Bruni, yeah.
He's going to be just fine. Carla's got this.
Yeah. So according to the Financial Times, the soak the rich rhetoric that has punctuated the presidential campaign has prompted a sharp rise in the numbers weighing a move across the channel. And what this is all about, I mean, the idea that the wealthy may have to pay a little more.
Oh, no.
When we're in an era of real problems financially. So all these people created it. It was, in fact, where is it here? Francois Hollande said, my true adversary in this battle has no name, no face, no party. It is the world of finance.
Yeah.
That's exactly who he says the true adversary. What he means is the true adversary of the ordinary person is the world of finance. I wonder if you agree with that. I agree with it 100%.
Absolutely. And Wall Street and the crapshoot that it is, it's all just kind of numbers floating in the air. Nothing that truly exists and nothing that has anything to do with you or I.
And as I always say, you and I did our jobs. We went to work. Yeah. You know, you did, your children did, your mother and father did. And then the rug got pulled out from under you. It wasn't anything you did. You worked like you were supposed to. So who did this? It was the world of finance. So the world of finance.
And George Bush and a couple of.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're part of the racket.
Yeah, right.
They're part of the racket. Because capitalism could work without it being a 100% racket like it is.
Yeah.
I mean, and will Hollande in France change anything? We'll see. I mean, one of the things, though, that he says that he rejects this policy of economic austerity. Now, I think everybody knows what that means. Austere means...
taking it over, man.
Does it?
Well, yes, I mean, like taking over.
Well, what it essentially means is you're going to spend less. You have to have you have spent too much, so you have to have an austere budget. Of course, what this has done is created a further collapse of the European economy. And the same thing's happening here. I mean, the capitalist world is based on the theories now. I mean, for no one will admit it, either maybe on the left, but certainly not on the right, of a man named Keynes. So they talk about Keynesian economics. And what that means is that the government has to spend in order to pump the economy, to prime the pump. So it is pump priming that does it. Lord Maynard Keynes was an Englishman. And during the Depression, I mean, here, there's, what do we do here with the money from the government? We this big wealth transfer. We took your, and I mean, if you listen to the show, you're always hear me talking about wealth transfers. That's bad. I mean, we want a wealth transfer. We want a wealth transfer from the ultra rich down to the average person and down to the working person. So we get the deserved fruits of our labor. That's all. I mean, is that real commie or real socialist or something like that? It is kind of socialist because it socializes income. But when you have that in capitalist countries, it still leaves the rich, and they're still powerful, and they still pretty much control everything. But you don't have the kind of grinding poverty that, you know, like we have in this this country.
Yeah,
all
and
right.
This the richest country in the world.
But back to Keynesian economics today. Well, man, I thought this was a rock station. Why don't we listen to some lecture on economics? I never could
for
understand it in
years,
high school.
Why is this guy still going on?
The point being is if you're currently employed or if you're a much younger person, say, in high school or something, this is all going to affect how you live, your standard of living.
It's no joke.
Yeah, it's not a joke. And maybe, you know, that's why they give us a couple hours a week to take off from, you know, the great rock and roll that we play here. That our main effort in playing the rock and roll is so a lot of ways you don't have to think about all the mean, cruel, challenging things in life.
Right.
You can kick back and listen to some music. Or if you're doing something you don't like working, you can listen to some music. It makes it a little easier. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, you know, we got to think about...
And radio's still free.
Yeah.
Let's go with that.
Exactly.
Okay.
Remember that film from the 70s, Saturday Night Fever?
Yep. Yeah.
And what was his name?
John Travolta.
John Travolta, when he's working in the hardware store, I sound like the guy that owned the hardware store. I said, you got to think about the future. And he says, F the future.
Yeah.
And the hardware store guy says, I'm going to make sure I don't say it.
Yeah.
You don't F the future. The future Fs you.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So you can be all happy-go-lucky about things and want to ignore. When people say, I don't pay attention to politics, I hate politics. I understand the hating politics, but paying attention really is important because it is your future.
And also, I mean, for instance, you and I have been involved in politics in our little suburb, and I don't even want to do that.
I know. It's exhausting.
Things are so bad. Anyway, austerity. So the idea is, let's start at the beginning, the Keynesian economics. So there's this wealth transfer. We pay taxes, and the best situation would be that there are all these socialized aspects to the economy, right? That's...
Mm-hmm.
The fire department and the police, the teachers,
absolutely.
The roads, you know, the helping people that can't help themselves, public hospitals,
the elderly.
All that. Yeah, that's all socialized, right? Some countries extend it considerably more. Or you can take, and then it comes back to us. That's the deal. It comes back to us because it finances in an orderly manner what the individual or a neighborhood or even a town or even a state can't do for itself, right?
Right.
So that's socialism. So socialism is written in to the American economy for, I don't know, last 150 years or something.
It's
like
much
that.
More broad than all the haters out there.
Yeah. So, but what happens in this country? Is that this vast majority of this money that, I don't know, depending on how you add it all up, but good portion of the money that's transferred out of our individual wealth goes to the military.
Yeah.
Right?
Meaning we're talking about taxes.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I mean, so if all of this...
I can't remember the figures, but I was just looking those up a couple of weeks ago. How much of the percentage of our tax dollars goes, it's insane. It should be completely reversed to helping with all of those, the list of things that you just gave, these socialist ideals.
Like the police.
Like the police. Like the fire department.
Yeah, like the roads.
On fire. Yeah.
And part of it, of course, goes to these wars. I mean, the reason that we're in the jam that we are is because of, you know, two things, mainly. And it's not because of social programs or anything like that. It's not even because the taxes, you know, aren't high enough on the wealthy. I mean, they should be higher. They should be a lot higher. But the main thing was thanks to George Bush, was his tax cuts for the wealthy. He cut them. The idea was what? It was going to create jobs. Well,
it didn't happen, did it?
Didn't work.
He created a big mess, didn't he?
And
guess who's taking the blame for it?
Right.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the unfunded wars, which is going to add up to a few trillion. And you say, all right.
And you say it so lightly when you say, it's going to add up to a few trillion.
Yeah. And that's your future. That's the future effing you.
Yeah, that's right.
And me, and your parents, or your children, or whoever you're looking at.
Yeah, if nothing else, think about your children.
Well, here, according to the New York Times, President Obama landed here on Tuesday. Was this last Tuesday or the Tuesday before? Maybe I got
it.
It was last Tuesday. Yeah. On a surprise visit to sign a strategic partnership agreement with Afghanistan meant to mark the beginning of the end of a war that has lasted for more than a decade. Whew. Isn't that great?
You know, I see these things and I just kind of go, uh-huh.
Yeah, except we're going to be leaving, 20 to 30,000 troops for a continued training of indigenous forces, you know, of those folks.
In parentheses, more people dying.
Yeah. And also spending another $2 or $3 billion a year. So it's going to add up over another decade to another $30 billion. And, I got another pile of papers here. Oh, no. Actually, here it is, too. The thing about Joseph Kony? What's the name of that thing? Kony 2012.
Oh, K-O-N-Y. Now, we're in Detroit, which is, we talk a lot about Kony dogs, C-O-N-E-Y. Let's not get confused. It was that big, huge firestorm on Facebook. I was just thinking about that, too. Remember that, everyone. This is important to me. Please watch this video. Everyone's like, this Kony guy's got to get... Yeah, has anyone really even thought about it lately until...
Could be.
Maybe now. I don't know, Peter.
Well, what's happening is there's 100 special operations troops from the United States in the Central African Republic in this town called... It could be 5 million people. Obo.
They're looking for him.
Yeah, and they got all the equipment, and they're trying to find this wig-wearing, gibberish-speaking, fugitive rebel commander named Joseph Kony, who's been hiding out in the jungle for years with a band of child soldiers and a harem of dozens of child brides. I mean, a particularly odious character, but not entirely different from a lot of these warlords that have risen in the wake of European colonialism. That's how Europe existed for a very long time, beginning in about like 1492, when the European powers who had destroyed Europe because of their economic policies, their religious policies, their ecological policies, all of that. The only way they were able to survive was they began looting the rest of the world through colonialism.
Yeah.
Yeah. And saying, hey, this is, no one lives here.
Little name, called Christopher Columbus.
Yeah, right. Well, the same thing happened in Africa. And, so the wreckage that was left has wound up in, Joseph Kony is one of the residue of the results of European colonialism. Mm-hmm. It's very horrible.
And like you said, it's so true, Peter. He's not the only one in these areas. There are a lot of cats like this over.
Yeah. But, he's been essentially defeated. So where we have this,
why are we trying to find him? Just to take him to court?
Well, yeah, but what happened was that this fundamentalist Christian group called Invisible Children produced the Kony 2012 video, and they pressured Congress to pass what's called the Lord's Resistance Army Disarmament and Northern Uganda Recovery Act. And, signed by Obama, nobody wanted to stand in the way that the Lord's Resistance Army is what Joseph Kony headed for a while, and it was a considerable force, but it's been scattered. I mean, they're running around, these 100 American elite special operations troop, in this area the size of California, in this jungle, trying to find him.
Real live jungle.
Joseph Kony and 300 people. And, they can't seem to do it. It's been a disaster. In December 2008, the new American Military Command for Africa helped plan an attack on Mr. Kony's camp in the Congo. Well, he wasn't even in Uganda anymore. But he escaped, he'd been tipped off, and then his army slaughtered hundreds of villagers in revenge.
Oh, Peter, and, I mean, this is horrible.
Well,
part
I didn't
of
even
this
want
article.
To read that. You want
Can
to read
I?
That?
I'm going to read it. This is what it says. His fighters mowed down impoverished villagers, sawed off lips, and kidnapped thousands of children, brainwashing them for use as tiny killing machines.
An absolutely horrible man, but we're spending tens of millions of dollars to apprehend him. But get this. Now, we're talking about wealth transfer, right? You and I pay taxes, your parents pay taxes, your children pay taxes, whatever. The United States has also pumped more than $500 million, so half a billion dollars, in development aid to northern Uganda, turning a former battlefield into a vibrant piece for the Ugandan economy with new banks and hotels. Now, these folks are in bad shape. There's
like,
no doubt about it.
They need a bunch of banks over there.
But you know what? So, yeah. So are a lot of American towns, like the one I live in. They have a, we have a $3.5 million shortfall. $3.5 million only. Right? That's what? That's less than a day of, what the United States, you and I have given to northern Uganda. And our little town is laying off police, closing its libraries, laying off, the city workers, cutting back to 4 days.
And the city hall, yeah, the city hall's closed on Fridays now.
Yeah.
Very inconvenient.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, and in the meantime, in Afghanistan, Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, and Representative Mike Rogers, Republican of Michigan, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, says, guess what? The Taliban in Afghanistan is getting stronger. So this incredible disruption, this destruction
just
of this country.
Just doing no good.
Yeah. Now, here's what it says. The Taliban, this is our enemy. And, you know, this isn't entirely true, because what happens is, just like in Vietnam, they called anybody that was resisting the United States invasion and destruction of that country in the 1960s was called the Viet Cong. Same thing here. I mean, imagine this. This armed force of foreign invaders come and essentially destroy your country.
Yeah.
Right. The Taliban, an extremist Islamic group that was removed from power in Afghanistan after the terror attacks of September 11th because they provided safe haven to Al-Qaeda. They didn't provide safe haven to Al-Qaeda. Like I always say this, they didn't have an office in downtown Kabul or anything like that.
They didn't.
They were out in those mountains near Pakistan. But the Taliban was never completely defeated, and after the U.S. military attention shifted to Iraq, they continued to fight.
You know, that's like saying,
they're horrible, by the way. The Taliban is absolutely horrible.
But that's like saying that Al-Qaeda will ever be defeated. The Taliban, it's always going to exist on some level.
Well,
gotta say.
One of the things that would happen, if the United States did not have military presence all around the world.
Right. They might not be so pissed off.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't give anyone the go-ahead.
License.
To do what they do.
I agree.
Yeah. I mean, for sure.
But still, that's the impetus for all of this. And I mean, Bin Laden told, what's that reporter's name from The Guardian?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
You know who I mean.
Who he met with and was, saw him again, he would kill him.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
And I think he did see him again, though. He allowed him to another meeting, but he said, basically, in just, simple terms, this is why we're doing it, because the United States continually has come in and killed innocent civilians in the Middle East. And
occupies, the
countries.
Well, yeah. and, you know, I mean, it's not like you think that, It's not a matter of anybody dictating policy to us. It's us wondering why in the world the United States has this footprint all over the world. No other country does this.
And
no
it's
other
an ugly country. Footprint.
Yeah, we used to criticize the Soviet Union for doing that. It was the only country that did anything like that. You know, the Soviet Union controlled all those Eastern Bloc countries. They would supply revolutionary movements around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all a big chess piece with the United States, you know, rival empires, if you will. Well, now there is no rival empire. We have no real reason to have troops anywhere else in the world. I mean, for one thing, if there are military threats, the United States has the capacity within its military
to be there right now, right, today.
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know what? We've always said. I mean, we ought to start looking at potential enemies and saying, "Hey, why don't we make a peace treaty?
Yeah.
Why don't we agree never to do this? Why don't we have like a nuclear non-proliferation treaty in the Middle East?" Which all, get rid of them all, not proliferate, but a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, and then Iran couldn't have them, and Israel couldn't have them, and, nobody else could. I mean,
Russia,
In the Middle East.
Okay.
Okay, so then that solves Iran, and you say, well, you can't trust them. Well, you can. You don't have to trust them, because there's ways to verify all of this.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then there's always the chance, you know, for example, what the United States does, we go to verify things in Iraq and make up a bunch of lies, and it goes forward anyhow.
Sure.
It's a mess.
I usually wait to the break to take calls. Just curious in this one. Here's Warren and Taylor. Warren, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
It's going good. What's up?
I just want to sit there and say I liked your first comment when you first came on the air. about you sit there and you guys play. You sit there and say what I don't remember exactly, but you sit there and say you're worried about what we say and then about what we're worried about, and you guys sit there and play great rock and roll and riff. I'm glad you guys are on the radio. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, Warren, that is wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Warren.
Yeah, you can get on these same airways by 313-298-WRIF.
And rock and roll back on at 2 a.m. after another hour and a half of us. Lynn. And then a couple of interviews. Peter, we've got a couple of interviews coming up at 1 o'clock. And then Lynn will be on at 2.
Sure. Well, why don't we do this? What do you think? Could we make a peace treaty with China? Could we make a peace treaty with Iran? Could we make a peace treaty with Russia? With North Korea? Yeah, well, why not? I mean, what the...
They're all different, for starters.
Yeah, they're all different.
I mean,
what are the real issues? I mean, one of the things that's wrong with people's perception, with the ordinary person's perception, is like, for instance, the Iranians and the North Koreans are crazy.
I mean, that's what people...
Yeah, they got a lot of crazy people running around. But, you know, like the United States...
North Korea, the leadership's pretty damn crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty wacky. But they're not crazy enough.
And Iran.
Yeah, they're not crazy enough to start launching nukes because, you know, their country would be obliterated.
Right.
They know that.
And they know it. Even if North Korea has that
kind
of China, the big armies.
And think about some of these crazy people that were in the Bush administration.
Well, you mean every single one of them?
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
some.
There was
all
a lot
of them.
Yeah. I mean, get this. And who is, who's crazy here? The United States, this began under George Bush. And this was the idea that NATO, it's having this big meeting in Chicago coming up next weekend.
It's not next weekend. It's
the weekend
following
after.
Weekend,
yeah.
The 20th. I will be there. In fact, I am like driving to Chicago and coming back so I can give you a live report. And
for demonstrations.
At the demonstrations. If I can get out of Chicago, honestly, Peter, I mean, I may have to call you. I hope I can get out of there. But David Rovick, singer-songwriter, is going to be there as well. And he's going to come in here that night. And
come in here
live in the studio
right.
and talk about his European tour, and we're going to talk about the Chicago. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, you can see. By the way, you can see his stuff. David Rovics, RovICS.com.
Yeah. All of his music available for free download.
So NATO and essentially the United States is putting up this missile defense site in Eastern Europe, and. So why is this? I thought the Cold War was over. I thought the Soviet Union was gone. Well, this is not aimed at Russia, according to the United States and NATO. It's aimed at Iran. It's aimed at Iran. In other words, we are putting up, and I mean that, you know, I don't mean the United States. I mean you and me, with our tax dollars, we are putting up these missile sites, anti-missile sites, and missile defense systems in order to protect Europe against an attack by Iran. I mean, folks, you think the people in Iran and North Korea are nuts? This is as nuts or more nuts.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they would never do
level.
This. Yeah. Now, the Russians, gee, guess what they think? They think that this is actually aimed at them.
Yeah.
Oh. Because that's the way it used to be, right? And let's see, the Russian Chief of Staff General Nikolai, how would you say his name? Makarov said a decision to use destructive force preemptively will be taken if the situation worsens. In other words, they might attack these missile sites.
So I swear, it just let it lie. You know, it's just stirring up the hornet's nest. And this happens several times a year.
General Makarov said the threat amid an apparent stalemate in talks with the U.S. and Russian negotiators over the missile defense system, part of President Obama's policy to, quote, reset relations with Moscow. What, to make them worse?
Yeah, because everything seems to be pretty chill right now.
Yeah. It's remarkable, said James Ludes of the Pell Center for International Relations, that Makarov would make this kind of threat in a public forum is chilling. Jerry Blackman, a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center think tank, said he must have been drunk.
Oh, God, because automatically they go to that vodka thing,
so,
right?
So, in other words, so what's up with these people? Why would they threaten us? Why in the world would they think that would be used against them? Well, the U.S. repeatedly has said the European missile defense system is designed to fend off an attack by Iran, but Russia has insisted the system would blunt its own arsenal. In other words, there's supposed to be this stalemate in nuclear weaponry between the United States and right. and Russia.
I mean, there's the stalemate is that they're still there.
Yeah, and
but they stored some of them.
And you can't have a shield in this because if you have a sword and I have a sword, it's a stalemate. If you have a sword and I have a sword and a shield, who's got the advantage?
Right.
Who would be most apt to attack first? And that's what they're fearful. Oh, they're so paranoid. The West would never invade Russia. Well, Germany did it once, twice, I guess, mm-hmm. in the 20th century. France did it once in the 19th century. And you know, they remember that stuff. So they're not being paranoid. But let's see here. Moscow has proposed to jointly operate the missile shield. Okay. Let's negotiate.
That's so sweet.
The United States and NATO has rejected the offer.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't that kind of make you a little suspicious if you were a Russian? And is there a person out there that actually believes that this missile system is there with our tax dollars to protect Eastern Europe? That's like Poland and Czechoslovakia and places, or the Czech Republic mm-hmm. and Slovakia. Slovenia, places like that, against an Iran missile attack. I mean, do they really think they're going to be sitting in Tehran and say, what do you want to do today? You know, they always mock them. They can't,
right.
You know, they say, let's bomb Slovenia. Yeah.
That's what's the first thing on their list.
I mean,
ridiculous.
Either these people are just absolute lying, which I think that Bush and Obama and the rest of them, all the Pentagon generals mm-hmm. and all, or if they weren't lying, or if they didn't mean this aimed at the Soviet Union and the Soviet, I am using Cold War talk. If Russia, who perceptively sees who this is correctly mm-hmm. aimed at them, why wouldn't the United States agree to this jointly? Why doesn't the United States agree to initiate it? Why not initiate a peace treaty?
Not to be inflammatory anything, but we are the bully of the world.
A big disarmament treaty.
That would be beautiful.
What do you think? Can it be done? What about China? How about a peace treaty with China instead of sending Marines to Australia, training people in the Philippines, fighting wars on the border of China? Don't you think that, I mean, what think
about
that
was hurting the world?
Yeah, think about that was happening here. That they had China, 100,000 Chinese troops fighting in Chiapas.
Right.
Say,
it wouldn't happen because the United States.
Yeah. All right.
Stop that.
Your thoughts.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com.
Have you ever wished your booty was a little more lifted, fuller, rounder? The Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa can make it happen with a Brazilian butt lift.
Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Gray. A Brazilian butt lift is a simple procedure. No implants are used, just your own body fat, giving you a fuller, rounder bottom with no downtime.
Well, that's a plus. So, Dr. Gray, how do you do it?
We take fat from your problem area, which are fat cells that are resistant to diet and exercise, and transfer it to the buttocks and make that area now resistant to diet and exercise.
So you're solving one problem and fixing the other by taking away the fat cells that I don't want and putting them in a place I do want.
We build up the volume of the buttocks, and my patients make a decision when they want to stop.
So each woman determines her final result?
We customize it to each patient.
Fantastic. That's Dr. Michael Gray from the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa. Call today for a complimentary consultation at 248-538-3333 or visit anewyou.com.
I'm Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Drive through McDonald's today and grab a totally loaded daily double. It's two beef patties with cheese, lettuce, tomato, mayo, and onions. And right now, you can get it for just $1.89. The new daily double, part of the all-new extra value menu. So grab the daily double for $1.89 today. Now that's tasty value. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
WRIF and the Henry Ford want to know what drives you. Visit WRIF.com to submit your ultimate road trip playlist, and you can win a $25 iTunes gift card and 4 free tickets to the new Driving America exhibition at Henry Ford Museum. Make sure to check out the WRIF jock video sharing stories about their first cars. Visit Driving America at Henry Ford Museum and explore how cars influence culture, featuring an unparalleled collection of historically significant vehicles, authentic artifacts, interactive play, and more.
Mike Rowe here at a Ford dealer with Fiona. Fiona here was just telling me the Ford dealer sells something like a new tire every 5 seconds. How's that possible?
Well, Ford purchases about 3 million tires a year.
Seems like a lot of tires.
11 major brands.
And you just sold one right now.
We also have what's called low price tire guarantee.
How's that work?
We'll beat anybody's advertised price guarantee.
Click the banner ad for a $100 rebate offer on 4 select tires.
You're not going to run out, are you?
Absolutely not.
Promise?
I promise.
Competitors ad required for tire guarantee. Offer cannot be combined. See participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 5/31/12.
This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
Now everybody, have you heard? If you're in the game, well then the stroke's the word.
Stop it!
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second segment. You know, I want to get to our phones, 313-298-WRIF. At the beginning of the hour, we were talking about the victory of François Hollande in
France.
Thank you. I would have thought of it.
I know you would have.
Who is a socialist, but what's really important, he opposes the idea of economic austerity to solve the problems of a country. And it really does just make things worse.
Austerity does, not his ideals.
Not his ideals, yeah.
Want me to read the email, Peter?
Sure.
Okay. Stephen in Farmington Hills wrote in and said, Michigan has many serious problems that need to be addressed. We get that for sure. But Republicans have their own priorities that they think are more important than jobs and social issues. Did you happen to see the story in today's Free Press about the Republican legislator from Petoskey that wants to change the knife laws in Michigan? I read the paper. I missed this one. It seems that carrying a knife only 3 inches long is not big enough for Republicans. Not only do they want longer knives to be legal, but they want people to be able to legally carry hunting and combat knives as well. What's next? Samurai swords?
You know,
what is next, Stephen?
What are these? Do these guys just stay up at night
thinking about guns and knives and their big, you know what?
And you know what? I'll bet. I just saw this in the Detroit News. A prayer caucus being formed in the Michigan legislature that specifically endorses Judeo-Christian tradition is drawing criticism. Well, it could be because there is the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that says Congress shall make no law establishing religion, and you have these people with a specific religion that are have a prayer caucus. What in the hell does that mean?
Right.
Don't you bet that this guy that wants everybody to be able to carry big knives is in that
as
well?
He probably started it.
Yeah. let's see. In its declaration of establishment, the prayer caucus is that it is a bipartisan body of believers in scriptural truth adhering to established Judeo-Christian principles and religious liberties that were widely practiced by the founders of these United States of America and the state of Michigan. These guys are so full of I don't know what. This is not true. Do you really think that all these deists, these revolutionary deists that thought there was this kind of distant God that kicked the world into being, but then it was up to human beings to shape it?
Right. And whatever happened to...
Where was the prayer caucus in the Constitutional Convention?
Right, exactly. And what was in there is the separation of church and state.
Right.
But it just keeps kind of melding, and it's so upsetting to me that this even is allowed to go on.
Representative Ken Kurtz, Republican of Coldwater, says he plans to chair the caucus, which he said is for, quote, those who so desire that want to join together for prayer and encouragement for one another on behalf of our state. We felt it was something that was very admirable. I mean, do you really think that if you pray to a particular God that he will answer it and do better? I mean, what? Maybe he'll let you have longer knives?
Yes, legally.
Yeah.
Because that's what God does, right?
Right. He's got a lot of time on his hands, so he can do it. Hey, by the way, the Republican convention, which is going to be August 27th to the 30th.
Oh, this is good.
At first, they were going to try to ban handguns from Tampa, but, you know, most of these Republicans were going to come strapped. You know, they were going to all have their piece. So,
yeah.
Actually, the right-wing governor said, that would be a violation of the Second Amendment, and these days it probably is, so that during the Republican National Convention, it will be all right to have a concealed handgun. On the other hand, what will be strictly prohibited are...
Water guns!
Water guns!
No water! That's dangerous!
Yeah.
No water guns, sticks, poles, portable shields, or glass bottles.
Well, we can maybe understand that, but no super soakers.
You can have your damn bullets!
These people are so crazy.
Sick to the core.
They are. By the way, this hideous electoral season, you know how long... You know how long this has been going on? It's going to go on another 6 months.
Too long already.
Yeah, in England or in France. I mean, bam, 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 and then it's gone.
Over.
You know, it's over.
Like what happened with Sarkozy.
And right now, according to this Gallup poll, and Gallup is a pretty conservative guy, and that always tends to skew results. But
right.
This could be correct. Right now, and there's always 3 or 4 percentage point room for error, mm-hmm. they actually show Romney leading Obama 46% to 45%.
Really?
Which is kind of nuts, because probably a lot of people would say they haven't made their minds up. But, you know, this does not even surprise me. I mean, on one hand it does, but people are desperate. I mean, remember I was saying...
Their own personal financial situation?
The Republicans are the party that caused it with its policies, with its Reaganomics, with its wars, mm-hmm. with its, you know, repealing taxes on the wealthy and what have you. And the Democrats, for all practical purpose, haven't been able to fix it. I mean, fix it to the point where there's people working.
It's almost unfixable if you really look at the big picture.
Well, during the Depression of the
4 years.
Yeah. During the Depression, the Depression of the 1930s, Herbert Hoover, went on for 12 years. And in many ways, again, we're back to earlier, we're talking about this theory, Keynesian economics, where the government is the pump primer of the economy. And, but one of the things the government did during the 1930s, it spent, figures would be comparable to billions of dollars today to directly hire people, everybody from to building bridges and roads and, you know, doing all this stuff out in the wilderness. And they had the Civilian Conservation Corps,
mm-hmm.
where they took all these unemployed young men and sent them into forests and, you know, replanted trees and did all this stuff.
Well, let's do that again.
They hired tens of thousands of artists and playwrights and actors and, you know, the Works Progress Administration.
Wow.
And they did all that. Today, you know, where do we put all the government money? For the banks and the banksters,
For
wars.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's not working. So, and this is what happens. And now with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela ailing, he's back in Cuba for more cancer treatment. They're thinking that this candidate that's opposing him may be able to beat him. But that's what happens. Well, these Republicans sure screwed everything up after 8 years. maybe I'll vote for the Democrat. And then that didn't work.
They didn't fix it in a year and a half. Maybe they were right away.
We'll vote for the Republican. I mean, is there anybody out there that really thinks what's his name? Willard Romney can fix the economy because he was a businessman. Of course, he was the businessman that bought up ailing companies, fired all the workers,
right.
and then sent them into bankruptcy. But whatever, even if he was the best businessman in the world, what in the world, what are the policies that are there? It actually is more austerity. One of the reasons there's so much unemployment, I mean, not necessarily the biggest reason, is that the Republicans have presided over the layoffs of hundreds of thousands of government workers.
True.
Particularly local and state, you know, county workers. So there's tons of them, teachers, what have you, been laid off. So, I mean, the idea is, I don't know. I mean, I would be so curious for someone to say, I support Mitt Romney because I realize that his program, which is the toot and doot and doot, is going to...
good because. Yeah. Let's go to the phones, Peter.
Okay. Yeah, you know, a lot
people
of
people are getting impatient.
And hanging up. Yeah, I don't know why
you
do that.
313-298-9743 if you want to get on in the conversation. Anything we've talked about. Or you can bring up your own topic as well.
All right. Here's Mike in West Bloomfield. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete, Julie.
Hello, hi. Mike.
Hey, I wanted to throw you a curveball, but...
We like those. Why not?
Yeah. I'm a local guy. I've been listening to you since forever.
Good.
And, what I'm looking at is the RIF anyway connected with the old AM station, WXYZ?
Yes. What it used to be, years and years and years ago, that stations, all the AM stations, which were the big broadcasters, right? And they had these FM stations as well, which was a frequency that really wasn't used. And
you had both.
They would simulcast. So what you heard on the AM station you'd hear on the FM station as well, if you had an FM radio. And nobody had an FM radio. Unfortunately, it's kind of like HD radio. But I think it's going to be the same thing. Eventually, we'll all have HD radios because
right.
it's a better signal. So WRIF, before it was WRIF in 1970 or 71, was WXYZ-FM. So, yeah.
That's the point. That's the point I was going to make. Back then, we all drove around in their cars and at home and listened to only AM.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you remember a guy? I'm sure you do. Lee Allen?
Sure. He's still doing a thing.
I had this wild idea that there's probably 100,000 of us in the same age group as you guys. I don't know how old Jalene is, but I know you've been around for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I'm a cougar. Let's put it that way.
Okay. But, back in the day, even though the bandwidth wasn't that cool, there was no stereo. You just put some speakers in the back of your car and turned up the volume and listened to your favorite, music and stuff.
Right.
My point was, it would be a trip to hear, 1 hour a week of, the archives of Lee Allen. And, people could call in and, request songs. And through modern technology, you could say, I got a call. Somebody wants to hear Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons or whatever. but I mean, for an hour a week, like on a nighttime thing, I'm sure that you guys,
well,
you can't have one of our hours.
Yeah, right. You can't have. I'll tell you, Mike.
This is a decision for the programming department.
We'll get back to you on that.
We're just a little talk show.
But it's fun to think about it. And there are a lot of websites, devoted to that. And what's that guy? Jeez, I can't think of his art. Volo? No, something like
that. Volo?
Volo, yeah. That does it.
He did this show once. Remember, we both took the show off?
Yeah. You know what, Mike? Email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
And
I'll turn you on to some stuff. Yeah. All right. Thanks for calling. 313-298-WRIF. There's somebody that actually does this. Hey, Mike from Fenton. Go ahead. You're on the air. I want to hear this.
Yeah, I know you do. Okay. This is a story. I agree with Mitt Romney. We need to be able to get complete control of the money. You guys don't know what you're doing, so we have to run things. And you had 4 years to do something. You couldn't do nothing.
Who's you?
Who are you talking about?
We need to get back to what we were doing.
You mean under Bush?
Yes.
God.
Wait a minute. Didn't you ever hear of the Great Recession? Didn't you ever hear of the two unfunded wars? Don't you hear about this big tax cut for the wealthy that sunk our economy and took all the regulations off of the banksters? You want to get back to that?
We don't care about you people. We care about us. We'll tax you till you die. We won't pay any taxes.
Who's the we?
Who's
here?
We and who is you? I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Well, us people with the money, we're not interested in bringing America forward. We'll have $4 a gallon gas.
Is he joking?
Yeah.
Jobs.
Okay, good.
And no future, no insurance.
He really is joking, right?
No, he's not joking.
Okay.
But you're joking, right?
Listen, no. You guys need to wake up. This is what we do.
What's his name?
We will steal this election. You will not get this election.
Yeah, I think we will, whatever the hell. Peter and I aren't Democrats, so, this we and you crap that you're throwing out is so ridiculous. And you really are joking, aren't you?
Yeah. All right. Hey, Mike, thank you. Appreciate it.
That's a joke.
Come on. Isn't there a real...
Are people really in the... Like,
now, I know there's some of you out there that are planning to vote for Mitt Romney. And here's the challenge. I think, and if you can't take this challenge, I think you either should stay home
or rethink it.
Do you have a reason that you could come on the air and say, I am going to vote for Mitt Romney because I think that he has a plan that will revitalize the economy in the way that Obama could not? Or, he said, Mike has got to have been kidding. I mean, I assume he says we want to go back to the policies of Bush. Let me tell you what else the Republicans are doing. You know, there was a coalition called Stand Up for Democracy. And what this movement wanted to do, this coalition, was to place the repeal of the emergency manager law on the November ballot. And what the emergency manager does, it takes these communities that are already poor, and because...
Like Plymouth.
Yeah, Plymouth.
Wait. Pontiac.
Pontiac, yeah, there is a difference.
So where are we? Yeah. And then
Detroit and Benton Harbor.
Benton Harbor.
And Flint.
Plymouth is fine, sorry, don't mean to freak
and,
out. I mean,
and part of this is this it's a Republican plan, because what they can do, they can actually put a dictator in there, and they can break contracts. I don't think any of this eventually is going to hold, is going to pass what they call constitutional muster, because contracts are contracts under law, but you can fire everybody, and what they want to do is destroy the public sector unions, because they see that as a basis of Democratic Party strength and all that. So what the Stand Up for Democracy Coalition wanted to do was to place the repeal of this law that the Republicans passed and Snyder, Governor Snyder of Michigan, signed to repeal this on the ballot. Well, last Thursday, what's called the State Board of Canvassers, they did not certify. They refused to certify 200,000 petition signatures, which was like something like 40,000 more than they actually needed, because they said that one line of type was too small. It wasn't 14 point is a height. Like if you look at your newspaper, it's probably 11 point or 12 point or something like that in height.
Okay.
And so the Republicans said, nope, sorry. You know, you can't, all 200,000 of you that signed this, the whole coalition that spent months circulating all, every county in the state of Michigan, they were told by the Republicans essentially that your type, your 14 point bold type that's necessary isn't there. Even though this group had, you know, experts saying that in fact it was. So they're busy that they're trying to say, anybody think that, hey, let's get everybody, have huge hunting knives. And you can go into bars too. with your hunting knife and your gun.
We got to get those guns in those bars, Peter.
But what they're really doing, the Michigan, Senate, which is all Republicans or the majority, they ensured that all but, and how many of you are how many Republicans, people that would vote Republican, you don't have health insurance? Well, they make sure they have it for themselves, because they ensured that all but two of the 38 senators in the chamber would get lifetime retiree health insurance at age 55 with 90% of premiums paid by us.
You and me, folks.
This is what the Republicans do. Oh, good, I can carry my knife now. In the meantime, you're going to be fronting the health care costs for these corrupt politicians. Yeah. So 7 months later, these same Republican state senators have drafted major changes to the retirement system for school employees, teachers, and the rest, and provide less lucrative health care benefits than they wrote for themselves.
Terrible. Absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
The people who are teaching our children, and these guys, all they're doing is passing just horrifying legislation left and right.
Okay,
you're right.
Yeah.
You're correct.
I'm correct. The Senate bill proposed by the Republicans requires school employees to wait 5 more years in legislators to draw retiree health benefits and pay twice as much in premiums as lawmakers grandfathered into the system, current retirees and up to 62 survivors of that. In the meantime, and I'll bet you every one of them is in this brand new prayer caucus. I mean, it just doesn't get any more awful.
Nope, pretty much not.
Than this.
Michigan is in a sad state.
Okay. Here's Daryl. Daryl's in Romulus. Hey, Daryl, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I want to tell you what. The guy from Clinton is out of his mind. I'll tell you the reason why.
Why?
When Bill Clinton was in office, the employers were crying for help. All through the United States, they were complaining that we did not have enough people to fill their position. Now, we have tons and tons of people that are laid off. Right now, I'm laid off, too, but I'm expecting to go back to work here in the next 2 or 3 months.
Oh, good.
Good.
Okay. So, in any event, the guy from Clinton is out of his mind. We don't need another Bush. What we need somebody in the office like Obama that is trying to get this country back on its feet and back up and running like it should be. We don't need another Bush novice.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Couldn't agree more.
Daryl, I got to cut you a little short because we got to do a break.
Daryl, I was joking.
Yeah, we hope he was joking. But anyway, you said it well in the short amount of time that you got. So we'll be right back. Give us a call. We'll talk more.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
Do you like what you see when you look in the mirror? If not, maybe it's time to make some changes. Here's Dr. Michael Gray of the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa.
Enhancing the natural beauty of your appearance brings with it tremendous boosts in self-confidence. You don't have to get undressed in the dark. I can provide you the body that you've always dreamed of. Let your mirror reveal your true inner self.
That's what we'd all like. But Dr. Gray, how does a person know where to start?
Well, first we have to figure out what it is that bothers you that's making you feel not confident about yourself. Once we can figure that out, I'll give you options. We'll sit down and review what your choices are so we can create a new you together.
So, ladies, if you're ready to get the look you've always wanted and boost your self-confidence, call Dr. Michael Gray of the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa for a complimentary consultation at 248-538-3333 or visit anewyou.com.
Don't settle for less than you deserve. Take the first step toward living the life you've always imagined and look as good as you feel. I'm Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today, and I'll see you tomorrow.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. It is our second hour at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm going to be airing a couple of interviews. One could be, I don't know, people say this a lot, kind of hyperbole, one of the most important interviews you've heard in a long time. I would say so. Old buddy of mine, Frank Joyce, now president of the Michigan Coalition for Human Rights, wrote an article for Alternet called, Is It Possible to Build an Economy Without Jobs?
Oh, right on. I didn't realize that he was...
You say right on.
No.
I mean, you know,
yeah,
like...
I didn't realize that he was with the Michigan... This new organization?
Oh, yeah, right. He used to be head of public relations for the United Auto Workers.
Yeah.
UAW. Yeah.
Okay, wait. Say it again. I'm sorry.
What?
The title.
The title, Is It Possible to Build an Economy Without Jobs? He says that traditional employment will not be returning to Detroit. Now, I know that might sound like bad news, but that new forms of work have to be created outside of what he says is an obsolete model.
I think a lot of people are having to become more creative and do things on their own if they can, or come together with friends or whatever it is.
Also, Rory O'Connor, who's a friend of Frank Joyce's, turns out, he's written a book called Friends, Followers, and the Future, How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media.
Social media that has morphed into really a part of almost everyone's life, except for yours.
Yes. Now it sure is.
I mean, it's part of our
social
job
media,
as a DJ.
Yeah, right. In fact, you can go see photographs of me and Jalene, facebook.com/nightcall. We'd like you to like us.
Yeah, there's photos. I did put those up on our Facebook page, didn't I, of us marching.
And the May Day,
Tuesday?
It was May Day on Tuesday, a traditional international workers' holiday that began in the United States in the 1880s and then was pretty much kidnapped by state communist regimes. And, you know, so rather than it being about working people and celebrating the working people of the world, it became these army parades in Red Square. Terrible.
Yeah.
But, Marina Citrin, who is she? I don't know. I can't even tell who she is here. She has a website called unionmade.org. She said, we succeeded before we began. May Day has been retaken in the United States. We are now again part of the rest of the globe where May Day is one where we celebrate our power, people's power. People around the world were talking about May Day in the U.S. before May Day began. And now those of us here in the U.S. have begun something new, something that is old and yet has been reinvented, the future of which is still being determined. as so many things are in our new movements. But the question is again posed, as with democracy and power. Now, Jalene and I went to the May Day observance here in Detroit, and I have to say, I was, and some of you right-wingers will be happy, was very disappointed. 200 people showing up, that was awful.
Yeah, I expected it to be huge, because all around the country there were May Day protests going on. And, for example, in New York, 30 protesters had been arrested on Tuesday. But
That doesn't sell it.
I'm just saying that means that there were a lot more people.
Sure.
Because on average, it's a very small percentage of people who get arrested at protests.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And again, the New York cops acted horribly. I mean, they went in, protesters there. In fact, I think I have it here. Yeah, arrest and clashes downtown as May Day protests spread. Around 3 p.m., a crowd surged out of Washington Square Park carrying a banner that read, "On strike." Officers shouted for protesters to remain on the sidewalk, but several protesters holding the banner stepped into the middle of 6th Avenue, where several officers, including one in plain clothes who had appeared to be marching with the crowd, tackled and arrested them. Now, why, that was unnecessary, but they love to do that. These guys are uniform bullies. One protester was led away in cuffs, had a bloodied face. On my website, it says if you still have one of those NYPD shirts or caps, burn the damn thing.
Yeah.
And if you think I'm just being harsh, go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and read what routinely happens to women that are out protesting. I mean, essentially sexual assaults.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Fortunately, has not happened to me.
Rick in East Point writes, "I'll bet you haven't heard that this on the major network news." Well, you know what, Rick? I have. Ron Paul has taken over the Republican convention in several states. Ron Paul has won the majority of delegates in Maine, Nevada, Alaska, Missouri, Minnesota, and Iowa, your home state.
That's all true.
The Ron Paul campaign told his supporters how to gain control of the party by becoming delegates, and his supporters listened and are taking over. I think you're dreaming, Rick. The banksters have it by the cojones, if they have any. Can't wait for the showdown in Tampa at the GOP convention. Well, I hope Ron Paul wrecks it.
Yeah, but this is great news.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, Richard has always been among us to beat the Ron Paul drum.
Yeah.
But then you send me something so totally stupid. Hopefully you're joking here. It says, "Check it out, Comrade Pete." And, I mean, hopefully.
Are we comrades?
Yeah, well, here, that the new Obama slogan, this is this right-wing newspaper called the Washington Times,
don't send me anything from the Washington Times. It's owned by the Reverend Sun Young Moon and the Moonies.
The Moonies, yeah.
And it's not a credible newspaper.
The new Obama slogan has long ties to Marxism and socialism, and it is forward. And it's got this whole thing about how, the socialists always said forward, I mean, that's it. That's the connection of Obama to socialism. He's finally, what happened? They say, okay, we're going to let it slip out a little more now. We'll use this old slogan. I'm trying to see even where it is. Forward is a generic name of socialist publications. Now, there was a long-standing Yiddish language paper called the Forward, maybe even the Yiddish Forward. I don't know. Someone can look that up. Or tell me, I don't know, were they socialists? So what if they were? They're talking about here the Frederick Engels and Leon Trotsky. Man, you're really hitting the high notes here, pal. Everybody's going to know what the hell you're talking about. Not you. This is not from Rick. So, Rick, please write and tell me you're joking.
Peter, we have phone calls. Let's go to them.
Phone calls. I remember.
Yeah,
this is a phone-in talk show.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, down in Florida. Here's Greg in Tallahassee, Florida. Greg, hey, you're on the air with Peter and Jalene. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Peter, I've had several heated arguments with you back in the
40s.
Back at the Fifth Estate offices and online when you first got on radio.
Wow.
Really? And undoubtedly you lost them all so badly you had to move out of the state.
I was taking everybody's arguing, E.P. Maple and Zerzan and all them. We were all arguing about everything.
All right.
Here's the thing.
Wait, here's the thing. Let's not be real esoteric.
Esoteric? I thought maybe somebody down up there in Detroit would understand what I'm saying. But
yeah, one person, me. Go ahead. Go ahead, Roger.
I've been an inveterate junk picker my whole life, and I've made a lot of money recycling metal.
Love that. That's great.
A lot of people got
copper,
rich.
Yeah. Copper, brass, this, that, and the other. And I used to tell everybody, the Indian got everything they needed from the buffalo.
Yeah.
I get everything I need off the curb.
Right on.
Well, you know, the
recycling's beautiful.
Go ahead.
So I'm sure some of your people up there that have recycled, you know, will agree with me that there's no longer anything on the curb.
Uh-huh.
I used to make $300 to $500 a month recycling, metal because I'm a remodeler. I'm a carpenter.
Uh-huh.
And I'd take all the stuff in and I'd also hit all the spots driving around town. There's literally nothing on the curb anymore. I haven't found a bicycle frame.
What do you make of it?
In 2 or 3 years.
Everyone's selling things.
That stuff's all been shipped to China. If we wanted to come back now with making stuff, we wouldn't have the stock to do it. We'd have to reopen mines and smelting places and start from scratch. That'd take, you know, years just to get back.
Wow.
Square one.
We don't even have the junk. We don't even have the scrap anymore.
We don't even have the scrap to do it. I used to know this old guy. He owned a junkyard down here, you know, because I work on cars and everything before they got computerized. But anyways, he told me that during World War II, you couldn't find a gum wrapper on the street, that the recycling was so complete for the war effort.
Because it had that kind of aluminum foil in. Greg, I got to move on. Do this. Email me and bring me up to speed on who you are and all that. And just email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call from Tallahassee, Florida.
Huh.
And by the way, that's not a private email address, just sort of in general.
The show email.
For the show. Yeah. Let's, by the way, I'm not giving the number enough, 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743.
Here's Gwendolyn in Detroit. Gwendolyn, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, Peter, I've been listening to you for a long time, and I just want to ask you, do any of you know how do they go by polling? Because, you know, I'm talking about polling minorities, when they do polls for political, who, you know... I don't know how, because I've never been polled.
Well,
yeah, that's a great question.
Randall, most people say that they haven't been polled. I'll tell you, every once in a while I get a call and they say, you know, you can't always tell, because sometimes someone says they want to poll you and the turnout will just be a salesperson. But they, you know, they've developed statistical methods that they seem to feel reflect reality. But, you know, you do find, you know, that there's such a divergence in polls sometimes. And a lot of it has to do oftentimes with what people are, you know, what the pollsters thinking going in. I mean, if you get a Democratic pollster, he's invariably they'll come up with good numbers for the Democrats. If you get a Republican pollster, but hopefully all the polls that, you know, come out of the New York Times or I can't Ipso or whatever, all these things you always see, ABC, you know, it's very possible. And I think right now, if you're thinking about that Romney Obama poll that shows people are dead at a dead even, it could be right now. People are really frustrated that that things haven't been completely fixed. And you mentioned minority community. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. A lot of times, I mean, one of the things I know in radio is that a lot of minority broadcasters say that their listenership is not adequately measured.
Well, and part of that is that I think that landlines are used for polling purposes mostly,
so
aren't they?
Get...
And so a lot of people have cell phones only.
A lot of young people particularly have it. Yeah. So I don't know. But the problem is, Gwendolyn, I think, is that it begins to shape opinion. You know, in other words, if you say, well, they're, you know, that Romney and Obama are even, people go, oh, well, man, maybe I shouldn't have confidence in them. You know, you know what I'm saying? So it'll
trying to influence them somewhat.
But it may influence one without even being the intention of the pollster. I mean, it's just nuts. I mean, it should go on. These elections should go on for about 3 weeks or a month at the most.
Yeah. I want to ask one more thing before.
Sure.
Romney's wife. I was curious when she got on TV and said, remember that late, I don't know, I forgot her name. She made that remark about how she never worked outside her house.
Yeah, Ann, yeah.
And a lot of people was getting upset about, you know, upset at this woman. I understand what she was saying, because Romney's wife, I'm sorry that she suffered breast cancer, mm-hmm. but she had help.
Sure.
Okay?
Yep,
she did. What you don't see on TV, they don't show the regular females that's got cancer and that got to work. None of the major stations, you know, don't show any of these poor females at all. None of them.
Single mothers who are working three jobs and trying to don't have a car, so they have to take the bus. I mean, people are just don't see reality. You're right about that.
Well, one of the things, what are they, Mitt Romney was born on, what's the phrase? He was born on third base and he thinks he hit a home run. Yeah, he was the son of a wealthy man. He became wealthy. At least his father, you know, his father, had more progressive opinions
ideals.
And and ideals and politics than the son did. And, I mean, the son is just a total opportunist. He's turned his back on everything that he ever believed. His health care in Massachusetts is identical to what they call Obamacare,
and he created it.
But yeah.
Now it's bad.
Yeah. So. And the idea,
amazing.
The idea, I mean, I can understand anybody who doesn't have a job, or anybody that knows people that don't have a job, or their home is foreclosed, or they're worried about the future, you know, saying, oh man, you know, I thought Obama was going to fix it and he didn't fix it. Maybe I should take a chance on Romney. Well, that's really, really taking a chance.
They already put out what they were going to do.
They did.
They was going to stop. What's that, McConnell? They said they was going to say no to everything.
Yeah, well, they
and
did.
People are, unfortunately, they're ignorant enough to they don't remember that. You know, it seemed like, you know, they just don't want to remember that.
Selective memory, and
right,
it's all
right.
Compartmentalized. People here today, here this minute, gone the next minute, right?
Yeah, they said they will stop everything. And if Romney do win, I'm afraid that this going to be a mess. This going to be a new method. Destroy the economy, stop the president from doing anything. They're going to try, even Democrats might try it. You know, they did us this way. It'll go on and on.
Well, yeah, I don't understand. I mean, because essentially, just like the 2008 election was really a referendum on the policies of George Bush. I mean, Barack Obama won for a lot of reasons, but one of the main reasons that he ran is that they knew that that the Republicans had wrecked everything. And so what is essentially in the works now is Romney is Bush 2, or Bush, what would it be? Bush 3, I guess.
Yeah.
Would be Bush 3, and if people want that, I don't know.
Have you heard about the possibility of Jeb Bush being his vice president?
Oh, they would never do that.
You don't think? Okay.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
Yes. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Mike. Mike's in Flint. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing good. What's up?
You know, I listen to you guys, and I've listened to you before. I've called in. It's been over a year because I went on the road for a job for over a year.
Wow.
But I just, you know, I listen to you, and, you know, I've also worked with underprivileged kids and stuff like that. And you know what? The whole thing is you guys say the social programs and the social this and social this.
Yeah.
I can't, it kills me. It kills me on you guys' thoughts. You know, the whole thing is to be honest with you,
mm-hmm.
in a perfect world, yeah, Israel be good from Iran, and, you know, Iran's not going to do anything. But if you look at the Muslim Brotherhood, you look at all that.
Wait. Let's back up here.
You've switched topics four times.
I never understood. You said you've worked with underprivileged children,
kids.
And then you said something about social programs. What, they're good, bad, they work, they don't work, what?
We'll stay with this. The thing is you look at where the parents are involved. They're not on assistance. They're struggling. But they're not on assistance. No one's giving them anything. Like the other day, a kid broke his arm. Had to have a rod and a pin in his arm.
Okay.
Wrestler.
Okay,
and,
so?
I sat with him. He was telling me thank you.
You know, really.
Wait, I don't get the point.
Wait. That's what I was going to say. You know, I can't tell where this conversation's going, Mike. Give me a general statement of what your concern is here.
You look at a person that has a family involved, and I see it just like our coach. Our coach is the only black coach in the whole mid-state thing.
This is going downhill
fast.
Yeah,
I don't know where we're going.
First he's talking,
I don't know where you're going with that.
I kind of have an idea that he's getting down on people who have
I don't even know. Don't even make any assumptions. I can't even get it. All right, Mike. Thank
okay.
you. You got to maybe write some notes. Or,
yeah. That was
no,
confusing.
I mean, really.
My head hurts.
Some people do that. They actually write notes. Hey, I wanted to say thanks to Brett, who says that he is a loyal Windsor, Ontario listener.
Great.
And he said, let's see, I finally got a radio which pulls in the riff, you and Jolene, so after about 6 months, I'm back listening to you guys. Keep up the great work. But anyways, he mentions that it is singer-songwriter, folk singer Pete Seeger's
93rd birthday
on May 3rd.
Ago.
Yeah. And
happy birthday, Pete Seeger.
Yeah.
We love you.
And Pete Seeger was the guy that wrote the song that the mass murderer in Norway hated so much. And we mentioned last week where tens of thousands of Norwegians came out in every city. Now, this is this right-wing maniac went in and just killed all these teenagers and kids. Because
based upon hatred of
Muslims, yeah. And he said that one of the songs that he hated the most was Pete Seeger's song Children of the Rainbow. And they sang these tens of thousands of people, downtown Oslo alone, 40,000 people.
Wow.
Sang this with Lily Bjørn Nilsen, played the song, and My Rainbow Race, that's what it was. So his was Children of the Rainbow, this was My Rainbow Race, same thing.
Yeah.
And Pete Seeger said it's a tremendous honor, really.
Yeah, Pete
so Seeger. happy birthday, Pete Seeger.
One of the nicest men, too.
Yeah.
So sweet.
I remember I interviewed him last year, and you know, he's an incredible singer. He's been singing since the late 30s or early, I think late 30s. And he said, two things he said. He told me, I can't sing anymore. My voice is gone.
Which is not true.
And, well.
I don't believe him.
And he also said, he says, you know, I'm an old man now. And he says, how long do I got to do this? I said, 25 minutes. He says, no way. Finally, and these interviews I do, they have to be 25 minutes.
Yep.
Finally, after 32 minutes,
you had to tell him. And
he sang about three different songs.
See, I told you.
Well, he was, you know.
I love him.
Yeah.
I remember the time maybe about 10 years ago. Gosh, time flies, doesn't it, Peter? When I called to set up an interview with him for you.
Oh,
and,
yeah, that's right. I forgot.
Yeah, and his wife said, well, it was just. You know, I'll go get him just a minute. And I sat there for 20 minutes. He was out in the backfield, in the back 40, 20 minutes.
They live where? Up the Hudson River.
Yeah, yeah. He was out doing something in the big yard.
313-298-WRIF, this horrible situation unfolding at the Guantanamo Naval Base with the guy who says he was the mastermind of... of 9/11.
Sheikh Mohammed.
Yeah.
So to explain what's horrible.
Well, that this again is just rubbing rubbing salt in open wounds. That the trial now of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the KSM as they call him, his co-defendant, they were at an arraignment at this military tribunal in Guantanamo Bay. Almost 3,000 counts of murder for the 2001 attacks. You know, that's
9/11.
Way, what did I say?
Well, you just said 2000.
One, yeah.
Well, attacks, but we're talking about 9/11.
9/11, exactly. Thank you. And so these guys would now have nothing to lose, you know, that Muhammad was waterboarded, what, 148 times?
Was he ripped that many times?
Yeah, yeah.
God.
He actually figured out how to, didn't even do them after a while.
He figured out how
to didn't panic.
Bypass.
Yeah,
oh,
he didn't panic.
He said, go ahead, waterboard
me. Oh, you're doing that again? Yeah. And so, but they had a select number of relatives of the people that died on 9/11 there to witness the proceedings. They wouldn't, They wouldn't listen to the translations. These are the five defendants. They wouldn't listen to the translations. They wouldn't plead one way or the other. They just totally ignored the court. And one guy shouted out, I'm going to commit, you'll hear that I committed suicide, you know, and they'll actually have killed me. That was about it. And they actually talk about this trial could go on for years.
Wow.
Yeah. And I
just don't even know what to say.
Well, there
about
isn't
it. I
mean, anything you can do because, they will increasingly appear as martyrs to people who see them in that light as, you know, heroes of jihad against, the United States. And in the meantime, this won't go away. You know, it's sort of like the people who are waiting for an execution of someone
who's killed their family member.
Who's killed a family member. And then it goes on for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years.
Yeah, so the pain is just, it doesn't go away.
And that's why, that's one of the 110 reasons that the death penalty is so bad here in the United States. That closure comes here in Michigan, like it always is, because Michigan has never had the death penalty when it was a state, that you say, okay, you're sentenced to life imprisonment without parole, and there's your closure. You mean maybe, you wish the state would torture him to death the way they used to do in England in the...
Or someone inside prison would
16th century.
Him, right.
But that's not it. The closure is... But I don't know, how do you get closure here? How do you
What's
end
closure?
You close.
Closure.
Closure. You say closure, I say cloture.
Sorry.
Actually, you know what? Cloture is something, is a parliamentary thing. Closure, yeah.
Closure.
Closure,
yeah.
You're right.
It's just like you're dumb in a tricks.
You calling me dumb?
No, it's dominatrix.
You want me to do tricks?
You call it dominatrix.
Dominatrix.
Dominatrix, yeah.
You think that's wrong?
It might not be wrong, but...
You ever known a dominatrix?
Yes.
You know what? I just tricked her because I never have.
I have. Yeah. Well, I've never been in the dungeon or anything. I've known a few. Yeah. Sure.
Her cheeks, folks, are flushed. So is mine.
I didn't tell you about my side job.
That's right. People still do that? I guess
yes,
so.
Yes, they do.
Let me see. You've been inactive for over an hour. Oh, this is on our Facebook page.
Okay.
Or is this?
No, that's... That's
your
that.
Facebook page.
No, it's not. That's this station's Facebook page. Yeah.
I'm completely lost here.
You are, Peter.
Yeah.
It's okay. Come back. Come back.
All right. One of the things, because I'm trying to find my... Okay, here we are. My website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And one of the things at the top is this thing, End Student Debt. And I don't know what you talk about... Richard, did he ever write? Check our email. Call
yeah,
talk.
He,
yeah, I said yeah. That, was he joking? Did he really think that Obama's a socialist because his campaign slogan is forward? Romney's is backward.
Hold on here. Someone did write from. It wasn't Richard or Ron Paul Rick, as we call him.
Yeah.
This is Steve from Farmington Hills, to the Republican nut job, that I guess they're calling you that, Rick, that wrote that in that forward is a socialist slogan. Forward is also the state motto of Wisconsin, and it's written on their flag and state coin.
Okay. And hopefully the Republican governor of Wisconsin,
Scott Walker. Steve called him Rick Scott. Scott Walker.
Anyway.
See you later, dude. Meaning Scott Walker.
Okay, so there's all this student debt here. The people in this country doing absolutely nothing. Not entirely true. There's been a number of political actions. And in California, there's all these sit-ins and what have you. But, in fact, if you go to my site, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, click on the photograph. All the graphics are... links. And this is an article from The Nation magazine called End Student Debt. But what is happening in Quebec? 12 weeks of daily demonstrations because the government said, we're raising tuition.
Yeah, they've been at it. There's been some really funny actions, too, like the Naked March, the Near Naked March.
They said, we're freezing our behinds for free school.
Yeah.
Thousands of nearly naked students marched through the chilly streets of Montreal to protest tuition hikes, careful to wear just enough clothing or body paint to avoid arrest. During the march on Thursday, this was the last Thursday, men stripped down to their underwear while topless women concealed their nipples. Well, you can say that now.
You can say
those
that.
Little babies.
Is that exciting?
With red ribbon or body paint, a sly way of avoiding arrest for violating laws against public nudity. And this was, let's see, the students, 170,000 students protesting plans to raise tuition by $1,625 over 5 years. I got to tell you, college students, you tell me, that's nothing compared to what's going on here.
Here in the United States, right?
And the thing is that in other countries, people don't take this stuff laying down. And why do we? I mean, we're the country that had the first revolution. Well, maybe, the first, but, right up there. First big one. I mean, there was like the English Revolution of what, 1688 or something. But, the one that.
Of course.
Of course. Everyone knows that one. I'm not even sure. I can't remember what it was.
But, of course.
The U.S. Revolution, that were these band of revolutionaries that took on the most powerful nation in the world and said, we are going to be free. And here are the principles. That we're no longer subjects. We are citizens. Mm-hmm. We have inalienable rights. They can't be alienated away.
We won't be controlled by the church.
We won't be controlled by the church. We won't be controlled by the state in the manner that England was and all the other countries were, where they said you said something they didn't like, they put you in jail.
Right.
I mean, look, this hasn't been entirely successful. In fact, around the Occupy movement, since last October, there's been over 7,000 arrests.
Couldn't believe my eyeballs when I read that. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. They're
I mean, we only see like here or there,
Uh-huh.
Little arrests here and there.
Let's take one more call before we have our break. Here is Kevin. Kevin, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're calling from Waterford. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I am. The thing I have concerns is that if you're a president, down the road, you always have this thing where history will always remember you. So whether you do good or bad, history has always a way of looking at it. Like, well, if you look at Nixon, he did horrible things.
Right.
And if you look at Bush, well, he kind of did horrible things.
Wait. Think about this,
Bush,
Kevin.
Bush.
Well, both. But, Kevin, think about this. Where in the world is George Bush? He's disappeared.
Well, he's certainly disappeared. I mean, he's fallen off. Yeah, he's certainly fallen off. But you've got to look at it like if you're a president, down the road, history has to judge you.
Yeah. Well, look at Ronald Reagan, one of America's, one of the country's worst presidents.
Yeah.
Gave us Reaganomics, started these illegal wars, made this deal with the Khomeini, the mullahs in Iran, had more prosecutions than I don't know what, had the, was it during the 80s they had the savings and loan scandal. Anyway, a thoroughly disastrous presidency, and yet everybody thinks, oh, yeah, Ronald Reagan, that was great. Morning in America.
Well, most definitely. If you look back and if you most, you kind of look at it and you go, well, he was one, a lot of people look at it as one of our best presidents, outside of maybe Kennedy.
Yeah, there's an organization that wants to name a monument or something in every single city in the
every
United
county.
States.
You're
every
not that
county in the United
yeah.
States after Ronald Reagan. We've Peter and I, once in a while, we used to fly to D.C. Well, we still do once in a while. And they have Reagan
National.
Yeah, we call it national. What did we call it? National.
In fact, we
leave the Reagan.
Because you got to remember, the first thing that Reagan did, and it shows you just how.
Oh yeah, was to deregulate the airlines, right?
No. To smash the pilots' union.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah.
That backed him.
Right.
gave you an idea of things to come. Give me a last statement because I got to do some commercials.
Kearns. K-E-R-N-S.
Okay, thank you very much. we'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
That's quite a guitar lick, isn't it? Hey, we're back, and it's our final segment, so if you got something to say...
Now's the time. 313-298-9743.
A lot of people jumping to our Facebook page. In fact, rather than writing into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, are actually going to facebook.com/nightcall. You know, I'm...
The way of the future, Peter.
Well, I'm not logged in or anything.
It's the way of now.
Do you really have, like, about 9 photos of us all over this thing, or am I...
Well, this is the new timeline, so yeah. Yes, I do.
You know,
did you want more?
No, I shouldn't. I know why you're doing this.
Why?
I mean, you look so hot.
Stop it.
That's why you've...
So do you, Peter.
Well, and you have to say that.
But hey, my mom has the hots for you. Did I tell you that?
Really?
I send her pictures on email just to give her a little thrill. She said, "That Peter Werby, I tell you." I'm like, "I know. You think I like him for his brains?"
Well, we can. We were talking about this insanity that Ron Paul Rick wrote in, and echoing what all these nutball conservatives are saying, that more proof that Barack Obama's a socialist because his slogan is forward. And they said, "This is what all these commie groups are."
Just one of the stupidest things I've heard all
night.
And
I was trying to think of the newspaper and Lorraine. I guess I can get her name's on Facebook, so I can say the whole name here, right? Or I'll just say her
first name.
Yeah. Lorraine wrote on the Facebook page that is a Yiddish newspaper, the Jewish Daily Forward.
Yeah.
So, there's more proof.
Oh, no.
More proof.
More proof. You know, on Facebook, we were just talking about student debt. We talk about it quite a lot. Last week, on Friday, got a comment from Christopher. And he said it took him years to pay back his loans, and he ate beans and rice and did not buy new cars or TVs until after his loans were paid off. Then he goes on to say, "Why, if I could do this over a number of years, others cannot. If others get their loans paid off, I want my money back that I paid back. And to which I replied, you know, everyone has their own set of circumstances, right? I think I was pretty nice, actually,
sure you were,
to the guy. And I said, also, jobs are scarce. People are getting out of college and not being able to get a job so they can pay those loans. Even $50 a month is a stretch for some people.
And if you can, it's not the point whether you can pay them. It's like people say, "I work 3 jobs."
I know.
And I'm thinking,
like everyone else is below them.
And why? But the point is, why should you have to work three
jobs?
Or why isn't college free? I mean, high school is free. We talk about this all the time.
I know.
But the point being, Christopher, is that you shouldn't have had to have had that kind of debt. Sure, you could. And also, I don't know when you did it. I mean, you can talk to some people that they went through college, you know, like a generation ago, and they say, "Yeah, I owed $500.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't quite like that then. All right, let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Here is, could it be? No, it isn't. Here's Rick in Farmington Hills. Rick, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing? Yeah, it seems to be a night of Ricks calling.
Right.
We like Ricks. Welcome.
I'm one of the Ricks that I'm going to speak out for a little minute here.
That's okay. That's what we're here for.
Seems like all the people in Washington are treasonous. Because when he's speaking out against the president we have now, back in the old days, that would have been considered as treason.
Oh, come on. We do, now, I don't know how long you've listened to the show, Rick, but we used to talk kind of bad about George W. Bush.
Boy, we still do.
Let the truth be known.
when there's the truth, there's the truth.
Let me tell you this, Rick. We used to have a nationally syndicated show.
Peter and I.
And we lost so many stations because in like 2001 and 2002, we'd call Bush a liar. War criminal, all of which turned out to be true. And, we lost all these stations.
We lost affiliates for telling the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now if you're telling the truth, you get called a liar and nobody does it. Remember when the president was doing his speech? And that guy hollered out, "You're a liar."
Yeah.
Yes.
They just gave him a nasty look, but nobody did anything.
Yeah.
Right.
And ever since ever since Obama's been trying to do the right thing, all these people that don't want him to do it have stopped him from doing it. And then they saying, oh, he's not doing what he said. Well, how can he do what he said if you're going to stop him from doing it?
Yeah, it's total like lockdown in Congress.
You know, they are obstructionists, but it is not, you know, I've heard it said. In fact, I was just looking at a website called buzzflash.com, and it was something about the Republican plan to destroy the economy. In other words, to make things go to hell in a handbasket, and they could say, see, look, the guy didn't do what he said, and things were still in bad shape.
And people buy it.
Forgetting about that, it was their people that put it in, you know, Republicans that made it in bad shape to begin with. But part of it is they really believe it. They really want to destroy the institutions that that came out of the New Deal, that provided things like the minimum wage and you know, health and safety things and unions and all. So they're not just they are aiming at Barack Obama. There's no doubt about that. But they really want to. They want to unravel. They want to return us like to the 1920s.
Yes. Huh. It's just like here in the state of Michigan. We had something that was putting Michigan back on the map. People were working. People were making money. Money was put into the state. When Granholm went out to Hollywood and got those people to come here, they came here and they set up so people could make money. And everything. And then Mr. Snyder, with his big hook head, comes in and tears it all down because he couldn't get his fat little greedy hands in the pocket. So all these people that were putting money in here packed up and left. Huh. Now, I'm saying this because, hey, I'm an actor. I get this book called The Hollywood Reporter that tells about everything. Now, the movie people then packed up and left. Yeah. Michigan Film Commission puts a big page in there saying, WWW, Michigan Film Commission, come to Michigan. They were here.
Yep.
Yeah, they were here.
And that's all the kind of stupid stuff that's going on that seems like, to me, it seems like treasonous.
Well, I'll tell you, Rick, what instead that he did was to give $1 billion to business, you know, And how did they do that? Well, one of the things they did was less revenue sharing of our tax money. So it means all of our little cities are hurting. Mm. All right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
That film industry thing just upsets me so much. How much longer do we have of this jerk?
I don't know. But, you know, we were talking earlier that these Republicans are saying that the Barack Obama slogan of forward is the socialist slogan. I got to hear a cough drop, a Hall's cough drop. And I don't get it. It says on it, March Forward.
It does?
Yeah, well, there it is.
Let me see this.
Up there. Yeah. Okay. Let's continue on. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Dave in Livonia. Dave, it's Peter and Jalene. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I love listening to you every week.
Well, thank you.
I guess what I wanted to talk about for a second was these trials that are going on with these terrorists, you know, for
Guantanamo.
Yeah.
To me, I mean, I don't understand. It just seems like posturing to me. It just seems like we're putting on these kid gloves. These guys are just insulting us in court. They're not responding to any questions. They're refusing to, you know, take part in the trial, basically. And to me, it's like, okay, so if it's against, you know, the United States government says they have conclusive evidence that these guys were the masterminds behind the 9/11 attacks or whatever, why?
You're kind of thinking, why don't we just summarily execute them, you know? I mean, it was ruined from the beginning. I mean, rather than having tortured these guys, which did absolutely nothing, to safeguard the U.S. or to catch Osama bin Laden or anything like that, if they would have immediately brought them to trial through military commissions or probably most appropriately in New York State Court, given all that would have entailed and, you know, that wouldn't have been hanging on. I mean, these guys probably figure, hey, I'm a dead man. One way, either they're going to execute me or I'm going to be trapped in this little cage for the rest of my life. I'm giving my life for this jihad, and I couldn't care less what happens or the idea of the military justice or whatever. So we really have ourselves in a situation with these Al-Qaeda terrorists at Guantanamo that I don't think there is any good solution, because if you try to have them do it in now, suddenly start this process of justice, it's like I said earlier, they're talking it could be years as this goes on. That'll be great.
That's what I think is a waste, because we're treating them like kid gloves because we don't want to make the extremists in the Middle East angry because we're serving our justice on them.
What do you think we should? I mean, I think if you put it up to a vote of the American people and said, should we just take them out back and shoot them, it would probably win about 70 or 80%. But,
well, of course.
But that's
well,
but well, how else do you not? I mean, certainly. Muhammad was not treated with kid gloves. He was waterboarded.
What'd you say, 150 times?
Like almost 150 times. Well, let me put it this way, Dave. I don't have anything to suggest whatsoever, and I'm not trying to put it on you that you got to come up with a solution, but any ideas?
There isn't an easy answer.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but they have to go through the proper legal processes.
Yeah.
What if they didn't and they just said, oh, let's just, hang
them.
Well, then that's going to create even more.
Then they'll be martyrs. Listen, they were willing to martyr. Well, I don't know if those guys were willing to martyr themselves. They were willing to send other people out to kill and kill themselves. But I think by now, I can't imagine that they're not accepting a fate that is not going to be good. So what they're going to do. Lost him. What they're going to do is just...
Were we just having our own conversation again?
Yeah. They're going to maybe milk it for what it's worth or, whatever.
Like MS, what do they call them? KSM?
KSM.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, either way,
3,000 counts of murder.
Yeah, damned if he does.
Hell,
damned if we do, and damned if we don't. Like the easiest way would be to take him out in the back 40 and shoot him.
Yeah, and put him in the ocean where.
Yeah, and then
Osama is right.
And then what would that would probably set off a whole chain of revenge for and then we're gonna go the legal route. So we're going to have this trial
it's going to last 15 years.
Yeah. They'll still be doing, there'll be appeals and what have you.
Can't win.
And then if they subject them to execution through the legal process, which they're eligible for under the Military Code of Justice, same thing's going to happen.
Same thing. Yeah.
So I don't know.
Hornet's nest.
Pardon me. Okay, we're almost, we got a few minutes more. You might want to sneak in, or we will just, as we say, clean up. The Republican war on women continues. Arizona Governor Jan Brewer, the woman who shook her finger in the face of the President of the United States, which ought to repel all conservatives, right? All you constitutionalists.
Disrespectful, right?
She signed into a law, a Republican bill, banning abortion providers like Planned Parenthood from receiving money through the state. And what that means, of course, is that that poor women will have to go without life-saving cancer screenings, birth control, or basic health care.
Isn't she a sweetie?
Yeah, so that's all these Republicans. They sit around and do this. How can we hurt poor
people.
Women? How can we get longer knives in the hands of Michigan residents?
Yeah, how can we open up those gun laws even more?
So we can take our guns into bars.
Because it's a really good idea to drink and have a loaded weapon.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Especially if you're an angry man.
Okay.
Right, Peter?
So... All right. Let me see. What else? Cleaning up here.
I'll tell you what else.
Go ahead.
The priests.
The priests.
We have more priests who are now not able to minister, Peter, because they diddled with little boys.
They did.
And this one is in Philadelphia, five Philadelphia priests barred from the ministry. I say to that, amen.
George Zimmerman, remember him?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he had...
not forget that.
He, you know, he was a guy, just kind of a normal guy. Of course, he was Facebooking, saying, I don't miss driving around scared to hit Mexicans walking on the side of the street, soft-ass wannabe thugs messing with people's cars when we ain't around.
This guy.
So, yeah, so he had a little racial profiling
just
going.
Just a little bit.
Although he had a Hispanic background.
I know.
He's, you know, runs this racist crap on his Facebook page. And he's also... he talks about his girlfriend calls her an ex-ho when she tried to get a PPO against her, personal protection order.
She's an ex-ho. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
And that also he's celebrating. He boasted about how a pair of felony charges related to his alleged assault on a police officer were dropped. He said, two felonies dropped to one misdemeanor.
Exclamation, exclamation, exclamation. It's like... You are such a loser, dude.
Yeah.
And a murderer.
I think, you know, all of this is going to come up because he has to testify. And the first...
I didn't realize he has to.
Well, he doesn't have to.
Oh.
But he's got to give a defense.
But he has to.
He really has to because under this kill at will law that he's going to claim self-defense, stand your ground, he's going to have to say that he felt he was in mortal danger.
That he stood his ground.
And that he stood his ground, and that's why he used deadly force against Trayvon Martin. However, the first question a prosecutor would say, do you consider yourself a violent man, Mr. Zimmerman? And
of course he's going to say no.
And then you just bring out the PPO, the fact that, you know,
domestic
violence.
Then he'd say,
do you consider yourself having racial prejudices? And he'd say, no.
Oh.
You know,
oh, but those Mexicans are all wannabe thugs.
Isn't
that, do you say that?
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure that's been printed off and is handily in the state prosecution's file.
And all these a-holes, as he said, always get away.
Away with this, yeah.
Yeah, and he was made sure that who he thought was an a-hole didn't get away.
So, talk about a need for anger management.
Good news in Japan. Thousands of Japanese marched to celebrate the switching off of the last of the nation's 50 nuclear reactors Saturday, waving banners shaped as giant fish. Then they've become this anti-nuclear symbol. They're called Kono Obari. I practiced it too. Kono Obari.
Good job.
So
they've the people spoke in Japan, and they've now shut. There were 50. Plants, I think, across the country, but this is only for kind of some routine maintenance. They're going to They're going to turn some back on.
Yeah, they have these Kono Obari carp-shaped banners for Children's Day, and one of the things they noted was that even though they shut everything off, guess what? They still had electricity.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so
it'd be nice if they just kept those off, but
here in the United States, they're actually trying to go ahead with this Fermi 3. Fermi 1, some of you may know, did not work out real well. We almost lost Detroit. Mm. Kevin Camps, who is the radioactive waste watchdog at Beyond Nuclear, who I've interviewed a number of times, told GE shareholders, remember they were in town a couple of weeks ago at the company's annual meeting.
I just know because of the protests involved.
Right. The high-level radioactive waste storage pool at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4 is at precarious risk of failure, which would lead to a fire and catastrophic radioactivity release, even worse than what has already occurred due to the lack of radiological containment over the pool. He emphasized the Fermi 2 pool, 35 miles south of Detroit, contains far more high-level radioactive waste than Fukushima units 1 and 4 put together. So this is, you know, in that song by Gil Scott-Heron, We Almost Lost Detroit, he says 30 miles from Detroit, just sits there. Yeah, he said it's an accident waiting to happen. With the loss of ability to circulate water, the Fermi 2 irradiated nuclear fuel pool could begin to boil off in 42 hours. Now you can say, oh, Chicken Little, you know, they got it under control.
Right.
I hope.
Yeah, this is the one thing you can't just cross your fingers and
I mean, that's
for.
The problem. You know, there's no way to secure this. There's no room for error.
Yeah, not any.
And you could say, okay, well, get that radioactive fuel out of this cooling pool 30 miles south of Detroit.
Doesn't work that way.
Okay, let's take them, and we're going to take them to...
Whoa, where?
There ain't nowhere to take them, folks.
That's right.
So every minute that these nuclear plants are churning away, and you know what they are? You know what the purpose of this nuclear fuel, what it does? It does not generate electricity. It boils water.
Yeah.
So you don't have to have coal or gas or anything like that. It boils water, which turns turbines, which then create the electricity. And there's no other option. I mean, you know, you couldn't think about conservation.
Or... solar?
Or any alternative fuels. I mean, that's ridiculous because what about the shareholders of Detroit Edison? And the other problem is, as all these reactors age, there's less and less money to close them.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to leave you with that. can we have, can we tell them a good story before we say goodbye?
I have a good story.
Well, go ahead.
Ready?
Yeah.
We'll be back next week for another show.
We will. Stay
tuned.
Join
us on Facebook.
Yeah, definitely join us on Facebook. It's just getting better and better and more photos of Jolene.
And you.
She drags me along to have an excuse to put us up there. Nobody wants to see me, except your mother.
My mother has a total hot
tip. Yeah, well, she's got good taste.
That warmy.
She's a cougar.
Yeah, she's more like, I don't know, it's more than a cougar. cougar's my age.
Let's leave that somewhere.
Okay, Marge is a cougar.
And doesn't she ever listen? Maybe she's listening.
They're Republicans. They can't take it. They just like to believe I don't do this talk show.
Okay. Anyway, it's at facebook.com/nightcall. You can go to my website, the old-fashioned 20th century website, PeterWerbe, WERBE.com. And thank you for listening, Athena and Sarah. Thank you so much.
For answering our phones and being great producers.
And stay tuned at 2 for Lynn. She'll have all the riff rock and roll.
Yeah, Lynn tune.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Thank you.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. We're into the dreadful presidential election season that just drags on and on and on. And one of the things they talk about when they mention Barack Obama's chances of re-election is his Achilles heel of employment, that we have not gotten back from the Bush recession to the point where the jobs have been restored to the point that people feel confident about the future. And, of course, any sound economy is based around providing jobs for its citizens, right? Right, everybody agrees on that. Well, not exactly. joining me in the studio is Frank Joyce. He's been a guest on this program before. And Frank Joyce is now president of the Michigan Coalition for Human Rights and board president of the Working Group. And he wrote an article for Alternate that's actually gone kind of viral. And it's called, Is It Possible to Build an Economy Without Jobs? And I'm sure every one of you thinks, no. Of course not. We got to have jobs. We got to have secure jobs. But this is going to surprise you. It surprised me. And I'll have a link to this article and also to our interview with Frank Joyce. And Frank's an old friend as well. And welcome back, Frank.
Hi, Peter. It's always great to be here.
Well, I suppose you should just start off with answering your question. How is it possible to build an economy without jobs? It's wage work and consumption that drives the capitalist economy.
Well, we do think that, as I say in the piece, the ultimate Tina, there is no alternative, is the very widespread and very understandable assumption that jobs are kind of like air and water. They've always been there. They're essential to human consumption, and that the J-O-B economy, as I like to call it, or to say J-O-B-S, let me put it that way, and economy, you're saying the same thing. Well, it's not true historically, for one thing. The J-O-B economy, the system of having employers and employees and the bosses and the boss and so on, is actually, depending on how you count, some people say it's 150 years old. Some Sure. people might say it's 300 years old. But in the, let's just talk about 5,000 years of the history of Homo sapiens, our species, it hasn't always been that way. So bookend that, we'll talk more about that, but it hasn't always been the way it is now. But the other point that I don't spend so much time on in this piece, I'm working on a sequel, so to speak, it's already not that way, and that's the trend, mm-hmm. that the disappearance of the J-O-B economy as we know it is very far along. We just kind of haven't put all the pieces together yet to figure it out, most of us anyway.
Well, the Ojibwe certainly didn't have employers and employees who occupied this land before some of our ancestors decided we'd like to park ourselves here. And tasks were done that needed to be done, but I think people would say, yeah, okay, maybe that was the case. Maybe that was even a better way, a communal way of sharing tasks and everyone being part of family. But we're in the 21st century, and if I don't have a job, I'm screwed like so many Americans are.
Well, that brings us to Detroit, Michigan. I mean, that brings us to lots of places and so on. But one of the other bookends of this piece, which was in part inspired by a conference that I was involved with last fall called Reimagining Work, and that was driven by the fact that Detroit is at a very advanced stage of what some people, I don't particularly like this term, but I understand it, what some people call a post-jobs economy. Mm-hmm. Because whatever goes on in Detroit, there's a lot of economic activity, but there are not a lot of JOBs in the traditional sense of that word. And let me put this in tax terms to help people understand it maybe. Yes, there was a time, not very long ago, when most people got a W-2. And a W-2 was what you got from your employer
right.
to share with the government about what your wages were. Well, the number of workers in this economy who get W-2s has declined very sharply. Now some people get W-2s. Some people get 1099s, which is what you get if you're self-employed, basically, or you're a contract employee. Some people are in the underground economy, so they deal in a mostly cash-slash-barter economic set of relationships. And we also have taken a huge number of people out of the economy by locking up 2.3 million people, what I call in the article the gulag of capitalism. The evidence here is that what we used to think of as an unemployment number that kind of went up and down and back and forth, those days are gone, in my opinion. Capitalism had a period when it created a significant number of JOBs. It's no longer capable of doing that for a variety of reasons. And so, to bring it back to Detroit, already, a lot of people in Detroit are trying to think of new economic ways to exchange goods, to exchange services, to get housing, to get transportation, to get education, to get the components of an economy that allow us to live together and function as a civilized society. It's already happening.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Frank Joyce, and he's written an incredibly challenging, and I said when he came in, a smart article, an alternate called Is It Possible to Build an Economy Without Jobs? And if you're still scratching your head, and we're beginning to flesh this out, but just one note on your article that appeared in Alternate, you have this line saying business-friendly mayors like Dave Bing do no better at quote fixing Detroit than charismatic crooks like Kwame Kilpatrick. Why can't Dave Bing make it happen?
That's a good question. He can't make it happen because nobody can make it happen because it's a systemic breakdown. It's a system that worked reasonably well. It didn't work that well, but we're romantic about this. I also say in the article, you know, there's a left wing and right wing version of I Want My America Back.
Right. You call it moveon.org and the Tea Party. They both want to reclaim their vision of what America was.
Right. It's not coming back, though, because a line has been crossed here. And capitalism, let me make two critical distinctions. And by the way, Peter, these are not easy ideas to wrestle with. I get that. These are really big changes that are underway. I sometimes liken it to when Copernicus came up with the extremely radical idea of saying, but wait. It's not the sun revolving around the earth. It's the earth revolving around the sun. That was not a popular idea.
Yeah.
People did not quickly, instantly say, well, you know, the guy's got a point.
Didn't he get executed?
He didn't get executed. Galileo,
yeah,
who
had to recant,
was an advocate of his ideas, was repressed by the Catholic Church. So anyway, I get that it takes a lot of conversation and a lot of thinking about this. Two critical distinctions. We all work. Work is intrinsic to human experience. We wouldn't have anything that we have today were it not for people having done everything from subdue fire to invent the wheel to come up with mathematics and reading, right, and so on, all of which preceded capitalism, and all of those inventions and all of those things that are the foundation on which our civilization rests were not associated with JOBs in the employer-employee form that we have now.
They were not market-driven. Okay.
They were not market-driven.
Yeah.
But we all work. Parenting is work. Growing a garden is work. Fixing up your house is work. Building a tool shed is work. It's the confusion comes in when we don't distinguish between work, which we all do, and which is inherent in human experience and in human activity, and the J-O-B system. And so part of what I'm posing here is let's rethink this. Let's reimagine the system that we have for deciding what gets done and who does it and when they do it and how people get compensated for it. And of necessity, to come back to Detroit just for a second, a lot of people are already doing that because they can't get a JOB because there's no employers willing to hire them for one reason or another. So necessity is the mother of invention, and creating new forms that use new technology and new ideas of how we get stuff done is pretty dang exciting, in my view.
Frank Joyce, you mentioned earlier that Detroit, in many ways, was already post-JOB, the jobs economy. And other people have said it's, and we'll start talking a little more about what people have been doing to reinvent life inside of Detroit, that it's also post-capitalist, and that that capitalism has shed and is probably going to shed even more people that were included in the middle class and the working class as it moves onward. But if you are in the midst of the capitalist economy, with for instance, with mortgage payments,
right,
and kids you want to go to college and what have you, barter and community gardens and whatever doesn't do much for you. You want a J-O-B.
You do want a J-O-B, although it's interesting to see how, let's talk about education, for example. There is, it's fascinating to me that one of the schools that the emergency manager of the Detroit public school system, boy, talk about a failed social science experiment.
Yeah.
It's the emergency management of the Detroit public school system. One of the schools that they wanted to close was the Katherine Ferguson Academy. For those who don't know, the Katherine Ferguson Academy was a very non-traditional school that had a very challenging student body made up of young mothers and pregnant teens. And they operated a farm, and it was a very hands-on
farm animals there. Yeah.
Right. Learning mm-hmm. experience. That is now a radical, a very different kind of charter school. Another kind of charter school is starting up under the auspices of the Boggs Center, in an abandoned Detroit public school building run by a woman by the name of Julia Putnam, who wrote a very fascinating article in a recent issue of Monthly Review about place-based education that you can find online. To rethink the JOB economy is to rethink education. It is to rethink transportation. It is to rethink food production and distribution. And it is to, yes, you have to give up some old ideas that don't work anymore, but some new ideas about thinking differently about just about everything is a part of what is, I like the term solutionary,
mm-hmm.
Which a lot of people in Detroit are using these days, is a solutionary approach. Does it solve every problem? Does it get your kid into Harvard? Are there probably going to continue to be, maybe for time immemorial, some, you know, a hybrid economy in which some of these traditional forms of employment continue to exist? A, we don't know. B, I'm very interested in not being doctrinaire and rigid and ideological about this. I'm interested in saying, well, let's find out.
Well, Frank Joyce, I interviewed an economist I know you're familiar with, Richard Wolff, and at the end of our conversation, I said to him, I've often posed the idea that we're heading towards a Guatemala model. That is, a third of the population will be well-waged and traditional, compensation, live in, gated communities and what have you. And the bottom two thirds are going to be, this word I've heard recently, precariat, a precarious proletariat. In other words, the kind of, jobs that aren't certain, no benefits,
right,
and what have you. And I said, do you agree with that? And he said, no. And I said, oh, really? He said, no, I think it's going to be more like 10%. So,
well, and that's what it already is in some places.
Yeah,
right.
And I was thinking, you mentioned the Boggs Center, and that's named after James and Grace Lee Boggs. Grace Lee Boggs, still an active Detroiter at 95 years of age, and some people you may remember. I interviewed her recently, and she and her husband James talked about that a coming revolution would be the first revolution in history where material goods would not increase would actually decrease. And that's hard for people to get their heads around. They want more. We want more toys, more gadgets, more stuff. So this would this is already addressing itself most dramatically, what you're saying, to people who already are having problems with accumulating stuff and gadgets and what have you.
Right.
They've already been shed off.
Yes. There are kind of two ends of the conversation. There are those people who are already excluded and marginalized from the JOB economy. And then, so if you're in that category, then you face a variety of choices, among other things. Do you want to see yourself as a victim, or do you want to say, okay, here I am, what am I going to do about it? And one of the distinctions, Peter, you probably know, that Grace makes is between what she calls protest organizing and visionary organizing. And I make that point in the article that this new economy movement is more in the visionary organizing of not how can we persuade the people who have power to use their power differently, but how can we take the situation in which we find ourselves and make the most of it, which, again, is the history of human ingenuity, long precedes capitalism, people trying to figure out how to take what we've got in the natural world and in our relations and connections with each other and improve our lives. And a lot of that, of course, doesn't involve material goods, because at the other end of this, you've also got obscenely wealthy people who are very unhappy and who are, you know, just as likely to become alcoholics or drug addicts or whatever as anybody. Money isn't everything in the sense that stuff isn't everything.
Yeah, let me use this as an example. And I wrote about this in an article that I wrote recently about the Occupy movement. How I got off into this, I don't know. But I was using as an example the Russell Industrial Center. The Russell Industrial opened, I think, in the late teens of the last century. It's this million-square-foot facility that was set up to provide parts and what have you for the burgeoning auto industry. And the idea that, as I wrote in there, that gray men were with this horrible labor discipline, because that was before unions and everything, marched in there, sometimes worked 10 and 12 hours a day, doesn't seem very inviting. All of that has been abandoned, and now it is a center of arts and of creativity and all sorts. Well, I guess it was a lot of marijuana growing, too, but
I heard.
So the police ended that, but that's not its main function. So, and this is the precariat, the people precariously posed in the larger economy. They're selling their art, they're selling their dress designs and what have you. And one, you know, it's not very appealing to work 10 hours a day in front of a machine. The other is precarious.
Right.
Well,
you've got something similar going on, and you probably know the name of it, and I don't, Peter, at the corner of Nine Mile and Woodward.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They call it the Rust Belt in Ferndale.
Yeah, right. How can I forget that?
It was a store, Old Navy, where they employed people, probably for not very much, but it was this big chain store that went out of business. Now you have people in there selling their jewelry they make.
My sense about the Russell Industrial Center, by the way, is that, because it's a few years old now, and my sense of it is that it's growing both spiritually, I mean, as an idea and so on. And I noted driving down the Chrysler the other day that they've got some new, they've repainted the exterior of the building. It's very bright and attractive looking. And it seems to me, like some other things, like the growing urban gardening movement in Detroit and so on, that it's a growing, expanding thing, and that people are coming to the conclusion maybe there is a different way to do things, which involves a different way of thinking about things, and which involves a discussion which is not traditional in, quote, revolutionary political work, for which, again, I give Grace and James Boggs and others a lot of credit. It means talking about values. It means talking about power in a different way than just taking power away from those who have it so that we can have it ourselves. It's a revolutionary way to think about revolution, among other things.
I want to spend, in fact, boy, I can't believe how fast the time is fleeing. Frank Joyce, my guest, has written an article, Is It Possible to Build an Economy Without Jobs? I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. And, I was remiss in not asking, I hate to ask you this on the air. Is there a website that you would suggest as well, or is it just link it up here?
No, I think that's I think that's fine. There is, but I would add, there is, and it's a little dormant at the moment, and some of us are working on this, but from the conference I mentioned that was held, extremely successful conference called Reimagining Work here in Detroit at Focus Hopes last fall, there is a reimaginingwork.org website.
Okay.
And it pulls together some excerpts from the conference and some of the thinking of some of the participants and so on. So that's another resource. Reimagining Work, all one word, .org.
All right. Hey, we just have a little bit of time left, and most of it I want to spend on a little more about the alternatives. But I would like to ask you, Frank Joyce is my guest, and he for a long time was the public relations director for the United Auto Workers, who are very concerned about jobs, about the old economy. And there's a president of the UAW now who I think is exceptional, Bob King, and committed to, not just to his own members, but to a larger social movement. Have you ever discussed this with him, and what does he think that this is all about?
Great question. I haven't discussed this specifically with Bob. I have with some other people in the UAW, and I would identify, and I don't mean to exclude anybody by this, but there are two unions. The UAW, I think, is exploring a variety of new economy ideas and new relationships with the community. And I was at a women's conference, for example, just a couple of weeks ago that was co-sponsored by the UAW that tried to bring some of the community activists in Detroit who are doing urban gardening and new forms of education and so on together. So they're engaged in this. And the steelworkers are now in a formal relationship with the Mondragon Worker Co-op that is a 50-year-old organization based in Spain that now has 125,000 members around the world. It's in the top 10 manufacturing organizations in Spain. It's a major economic power with a multi-billion dollar annual revenue stream, but which is not based on traditional boss-worker relationships. So I'd also call out Gar Alperovitz, who has a book out, the name of which is escaping me at the moment. But, Peter, maybe you can find that and put it on the website also, who says, without anybody paying attention to this, this new economy, this alternative economy, and I mentioned him and some others in the article, is already more an economic force than people are generally thinking.
Well, we're not going to have a lot of time to talk too much about alternatives. I suspect that the leading edge of all of this, as you're indicating, Frank Joyce, is in Detroit. For one thing, there's a lot of space there for urban agriculture, which doesn't exist in a lot of, in fact, in Oak Park, I don't know if you saw that, some woman was growing a little garden in the front yard, and she got arrested for it. But I think that people are maybe thinking that a new economy that's not based on jobs, that people are looking at Detroit as sort of an incubator, or is this going to work? Because I'm not going to abandon what I have now or even searching for maybe what I don't have now, like a job, if this is not going to work in Detroit. So there's a lot riding on that.
Oh, I agree. But I also, for this very reason, it's not huge, but one thing Detroit needs is immigrants, and Detroit is attracting immigrants who are attracted to this economic model. Maybe because they can't buy a house for $2,000 someplace else, or maybe because they can't find a job no matter how they try. But you'd be surprised at the number of people who are visiting Detroit, moving to Detroit, returning to Detroit because of excitement about this new economy evolution.
Yeah, and when we were talking about immigrants, we're talking about people from Roseville or...
From Roseville or from Europe or from...
Yeah.
From
there
all
are,
over.
Yeah, there's an exciting art scene, for instance, that people are emigrating to. There is, in fact, around Wayne State University, I was there, and I'm just always astounded at how much is developing there among the arts and restaurants and boutiques, although that still is middle class. I mean, we're talking about the necessity of people that have been shed off by capitalism, that are actually in a post-capitalist existence. How do they live? And it's about work, not about jobs.
It is about work, not about jobs.
Frank Joyce, thank you, as usual, for coming in. This incredible article, I would suggest everybody link to my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, or you can just do a search for it. Is it possible to build an economy without jobs? Originally published by Alternate. Frank, as usual, thanks for being on the broadcast.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, there's people listening that distinctly remember they would get a phone call and it would be like this. Hello, this is the operator calling. Is this James Smith? I have a collect call person to person from Alice Smith. And you would have to decide whether you wanted to take it or not, because it was very expensive if you got a person-to-person collect call. And there's people around that remember dial phones, and people that remember when there wasn't internet, and people that are listening that remember when there wasn't iPhones or cell phones and what have you. First cell phone I ever saw looked like one of those huge walkie-talkies that they used on battlefields in World War II. Now, there's a lot of you listening that are what our guest refers to as digital natives. It was all here, as soon as you kind of popped into consciousness. My guest is Rory O'Connor. He's written an incredible book. It's called Friends, Followers, and the Future. And the subtitle kind of sums up what we're going to talk about, how social media and changing politics threaten big brands and killing traditional media. And Rory O'Connor is a writer, a filmmaker, and journalist whose work centers around media and politics. He's written Shock Jocks, Hate Speech, and Talk Radio. I just learned that when I looked at the book. I'd like to see that. He also co-authored Nuke Speak, The Selling of Nuclear Power. Gee, I almost said it like Bush, didn't I? The Selling of Nuclear Power from the Manhattan Project to Fukushima. And he is a longtime blogger for sites such as Huffington Post, Alternet, and he has his own blog. Media is a plural. You can reach his website where the book is listed as well at roryoconnor.org. It's a pleasure to welcome Rory O'Connor to our microphones. Hi, Rory. You know, I forgot to ask you where we're reaching you. What city on the planet?
Yes, good morning. Thank you. It's a great pleasure. I'm sitting here in Oakland, California at the moment, in the middle of the proverbial book tour, if you will. And last night we had a great event at City Lights bookstore here in San Francisco, which, of course, in addition to being one of the leading independent booksellers, is the publisher of my book. So I'm very pleased to be associated with City Lights, and frankly, anything that mentions my name and my work in the same breath as Lawrence Ferlinghetti, the creator of City Lights, just has me in awe.
And the world, or the, at least the country's, one of the country's great poets, still alive at 92, 3?
92, still alive and still very active
yeah.
At City Lights.
Incredible guy. Let's get to your book. As I said, there are some people that are sort of still befuddled by the digital age they have. For older folks, they have those little phones that say, with big numbers on it, and yet, as you said, the digital natives, it's all native to them. What's the title mean? Friends, Followers, and the Future?
Well, friends, obviously, as in Facebook friends. Followers, as in Twitter followers. And the future, obviously, where we're going from here. What I posit in the book is that we're literally in the middle of an ongoing revolution. And I don't mean just a political revolution, although, of course, it has its political aspects, as we see domestically from the Occupy movement and internationally from the Arab Spring and so on. But there's a larger revolution going on, the digital information revolution, and that is one that is basically transforming, vast swaths of society, and transforming the very ways that we live, work, play, do business, and vote, and most importantly, communicate with each other.
Well, I'm going to haul out my dinosaur credentials and say, is that good? Yeah. To me, I have information overload, and I don't notice people getting any smarter, and I don't notice people being able to link into one another human to human any more than we did before all this. But so I think you think, and you say in Friends, Followers, in the Future, that there are some mixed aspects to it.
Well, exactly. You know, as I said, we're living in the middle of a revolution. Now, revolutions are messy, they're chaotic, they're confusing, there are winners and there are losers, and there's a lot of conflict. So, you know, it's a complicated question as to whether it's good or bad. What I will say is it has aspects of both. On the good side is the democratization of both creating and distributing news and information. As you know, back in the day, back in that 20th century that we don't dimly recall, the media system was much more centralized, and as a result, it was, what I call a professional priesthood of journalists who were the ones who controlled not only producing news, but also distributing it to us via the old kind of top-down hierarchical, broadcast model, if you will. So if things are now happening that the ability to make and create media and also to redistribute your own media and other media to, literally the whole world is now, flowing down to people like you and me, how can that not be a good thing?
Well,
on the other hand, at the very same time, you're right, we're facing a tsunami of unvetted and unverified news and information that's flooding over us and frankly threatening to drown all of us. So that's the bad part of it, and I address both the good and the bad in the book and, in some detail, and try also, looking forward, the future part of this, to give some people some practical methods that they can deal with this problem.
Now, when they had the centralization of media, as you said, there were like three networks and a couple daily papers here in Detroit, and same around the country, some national magazines and what have you. And there was trust in them, and there was also oppositional press. There were small socialists, even communist magazines. There was union papers, and again, posing them as oppositional. And people either trusted the Detroit News, which I never did. I mean, we used to say you could read what they wrote, and then you knew the opposite was true. Sort of like,
well, that's also a form of trust, if you will.
Yeah.
Where they're coming from, and they were completely wrong.
And then I would wait until I got my weekly National Guardian newspaper, because there I knew was, quote, the truth. Now, people, I would suspect, if they're discerning at all, they're neutral. It's kind of hard to, like you just said, Rory O'Connor, that how do we make any ascertainment as to what is, the old sophomoric question, what is reality? I mean, that it seems more difficult now.
Well, in some aspects it is, and in others it isn't. It's more difficult because there's really no central force that we can look to. There's no Detroit News, if you will, that even if we disagree with it, we know where they're coming from, and we have a relationship over time with their news and information that we can use as a basis for judging. But as I said, on the other hand, let's flash back, for some of your older listeners, if you will. Back in the day, as you say, there were three national news broadcast networks that delivered the news. There was a fellow named Walter Cronkite, who was the number one and the most trusted journalist in America. And he would end the CBS News every night by signing off and saying, "And that's the way it is."
Right.
Literally presenting like this is the truth. This is the only truth. So we now live in a world where there are literally billions of people who are reporting the news, and there's billions of ways that's the way it is. So we have, much more varied and multiple points of view before this. So as I said, on the one hand, a diversity of viewpoints is a good thing. We're exposed to a lot more news and information that perhaps in the past we weren't. The problem is that we're getting all this information that, frankly, is no longer being pre-vetted and verified by anyone. It's just going out there and traveling at the speed of light. So, for example, Twitter. I'm a big fan of Twitter, and I have been almost since its inception. I think it's an incredible tool for journalism, among other things. That being said, there's, as you know, there's always been a conflict between speed and accuracy in journalism. And what we're seeing now is that speed is beginning to triumph over accuracy. So the race to be first, to tweet it first without even bothering to check whether it's true or not, is something that we see time and time again. So I think that we're grappling, as I said, in a revolutionary situation with a lot of new experiences. And, you know, people don't have the background that they used to have in the trusted relationships. So that's why we mm-hmm. need to develop what I call new trust filters, shortcuts, if you will, that can assist us in dealing with the flood of information that's washing all over all of us. I mean, frankly, no one has the time or the ability, if you have any kind of a normal life, a family, a job, whatever, as most of us do, to deal with all this information and to make those judgments themselves. Now, back in the day, for good or for ill, the legacy media performed that function of gatekeeping. Well, for a variety of reasons, they do very little of that now, and that has yet to be replaced by any other entity. So that's why I say that it's incumbent on, you know, us as individuals and citizens now to come up with some shortcuts to deal with it, because it's very important that we have reliable and trustworthy news and information, whether it's as a consumer to figure out what automobile we want to buy from Detroit, for example, or whether it's as a citizen to know whether the politicians are lying to us or not, or, you know, whether it's just looking at the news and information from journalism and trying to figure out if, well, is President Obama really a Muslim or not?
Right. My guest is, pardon me, Rory O'Connor. He's written Friends, Followers, and the Future, How Social Media and Changing Politics How social media and changing politics, threatening big brands and killing traditional media. It is available from City Lights Books. You can go to Rory's website, roryoconnor.org. And I learned that it's not .com because Rory O'Connor was actually the last king of Ireland. So does his relatives have .com?
I think it's a historical society dedicated to his memory and to eliminating the British from the six counties that they still occupy.
There you go. All right. Let's turn a little or a lot to Facebook. People say to me, Peter, why don't you have a Facebook page? You're so engaged. You do politics. You do all this radio. You do talk shows. You're so up on the news. And plus, people you haven't seen in 25 years will get a hold of you. And I said, well, that's strike three, the last one. But I am so overwhelmed with media, with news sites, with all these email accounts that I have, with reading newspapers and all of that, that I don't want it to consume any more of my life. And I'm always struck by how much people are involved with Facebook. What is the level of almost addiction here that people find so compelling? And again, that has an up and a downside.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was just about to say. And, you know, for example, a lot of the things you're describing, this manifold of media experiences, a lot of people are now concentrating within Facebook itself. So I think that's part of the attraction. You know, rather than be overwhelmed by email, you can communicate through Facebook, for example. So it's a way to combine a lot of these media sources into one place. And there are, you know, different programs and so on that help you to organize that information. But, you know, another really, I was talking a moment ago about the need for shortcuts and filters to find the news and information. And the number one emerging news filter I posited are the social media themselves, such as Facebook. Now, I have actually two chapters in the book on Facebook. It's that important. And the first one, I begin by quoting a fellow named David Kirkpatrick, who was writing in 2007 in Fortune magazine. And he said, imagine that you knew which sites or what news stories people you trust found useful and which they disliked. This isn't fantasy. Facebook might make it possible, and soon. Yes, the social networking site college kids spend so much time on, the one you thought was just about hooking up, could turn out to be more important than any of us thought. Now, that was only 5 years ago, but, you know, Facebook was really only created a few years ago. And so in a very short period of time, I think that that prediction by Kirkpatrick, who, of course, went on to write the best-selling book, The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company connecting the world, was very prescient, because in the startlingly short period of time, Facebook did make it possible for us to find trusted and useful news sites and stories, along with much, much more. So I think that that is a large part of the attraction of Facebook, is that it can function as one of these shortcuts or trust filters for you. On the other hand, yes, there are a lot of problems with Facebook. And again, it centers, to my mind, around the issue of trust. Can we trust Facebook with our own private information? And what they've revealed thus far over time is the answer repeatedly has been no.
Well, privacy, that's something, that's 20th century.
Well, that's what Mark Zuckerberg says, right, that the age of privacy is over.
Well, people have always said, if I have nothing to hide, remember, even when, you know, say, well, what do I care if I'm being snooped on by the government, or that there's no warrants for, you know, a search, if I have nothing to hide. But that was, the founding fathers were so concerned about the right of individual privacy that it's in, that it's enshrined in our Constitution. And yet, as you say, it's beginning to kind of erode, or not kind of, it is eroding.
Well, I think the issue, frankly, is not exactly privacy. The issue is who controls that, and who can we trust?
And so, what do they do with it? Yeah.
It is true that a lot of young people, the digital natives, are, you know, willing to be less private about themselves than perhaps people, you know, of our generation. But to my mind, the question is, have you asked me for my permission, okay? Have I given you permission to reveal these things about myself or not? Who controls the information? Do I, do you, Facebook, or is there some combination of us where we have a trusting relationship that I know I can share some of this information with you, and you're not going to go behind my back, make it public, and sell it and make $100 billion off of it, at least not without giving me my share?
Well, you know, this reminds me, in fact, you mentioned earlier in terms of Twitter about speed versus accuracy, and now we're looking at, you know, Google is being under the microscope by the government, Facebook, lawsuits. All of this is very reminiscent of the century. We were being very snarky about the 20th century. At the end of the 19th century, the same thing was true with the newspapers. They had the telegraph, and they wanted to get everything in the paper as soon as possible. The scoops, they didn't care whether it was accurate or not. And then the development of the automobile, particularly here in the Detroit area, they were suing each other. They were this cutthroat competition. There were, you know, is there a similarity? And you said we're at the beginning of a revolution. Will this all eventually shake out, you think?
I think it will. I hope it will. There's no reason why it cannot. But what is required, frankly, is for, you know, individuals to become active and get involved. And, you know, one of the things that I have noticed is that there is a generational divide, as you mentioned, largely on this, that the young people that who've grown up with this so-called digital natives, it seems to be second nature to them. Obviously, to older people, it's not. And one of the things that I find is that people who are older are generally, first of all, they're a little resistant to change, and also we fear appearing ignorant, okay? You know, since we're old, we're expected to know things. Now, these technologies were only created in the last 5 or 6 years. There's no way that we could really be expected to know them. But we're afraid of them because, you know, the young people know everything about it. We don't know how to do it, so we shy away from it. So I encourage people to abandon that attitude, to not stick their head in the sands. It's not hard to learn. There are, you know, many, many ways to do it. There are videos online. But the real message is get in there, roll your sleeves up, experiment, learn how to play with these things in that spirit of play. And I think eventually, as you become more familiar and more comfortable with them, that at least opens up the possibility for a future of very positive change.
Mm-hmm. Rory O'Connor, I don't know if you're familiar with the science fiction film. Gee, now it's like over 40 years old. THX 1138, it was the original first George film Lucas. By George Lucas, yeah. And it was about this dystopian future, and everyone is controlled by these robot police officers and the mandatory use of drugs that suppress emotion. And when the protagonist stops taking the drugs, he realizes that everything is moving so incredibly fast and everything is almost out of control if it's not, if you don't have these drugs inside you. And I guess the point I'm making, that we can do this speed, but ultimately, doesn't it make the world too fast? Or is this just an old guy talking?
Look,
or both.
We're living in a world that news and information literally is traveling at the speed of light.
Yeah.
Literally. You push a button on your computer and your information appears half a world away in a nanosecond. So there's no turning back from that, if you will. But yes, the speed has created a new set of issues and complications, and now we need to adjust the system to deal with that. There's always been, as you mentioned, right from the very beginning when the Reuters wire service began using carrier pigeons to scoop the competition, there's always been a need to be first in journalism. That's part of your competitive advantage, if you will. But you also have to be accurate, and if you're first and inaccurate over time, people are going to lose trust in the news and information you're providing, and then they're going to lose trust in you and your brand. So one of the points I make in the book is that, as I said before, trust is really the central issue uniting all these things. And trust, of course, is also essential for the success of any brand, whether it's the old legacy media that we've learned over time are not particularly trustworthy, whether it's the new brands like Google and Facebook. So, Mark Zuckerberg, the creator of Facebook, he may think that the age of privacy is over and that these recent privacy flaps and investigation haven't affected Facebook much, but they actually represent a huge potential threat to everything that he has built.
Well, I wonder if there will be people beginning to fry out on the volume. In other words, when we read about young people getting 100 and 200 texts a day, or if my wife and I are out in a restaurant and there's a young couple, beautiful young woman dressed incredibly, and there's a guy sitting there with a ball cap on and he's not looking at her.
He's not even looking at her.
There's a whole different set of social mores. I mean, the idea that you would be with somebody and paying attention to something else, that's okay now, but I just wonder whether there's a point at which people are going to say, okay, maybe I only need to send about two or three texts a day rather than 33 or 43 or 73.
Well, it's the connections with people who are craving, so I don't think they're going to be moving away from connecting. I just think that we need to do it in a more thoughtful manner, if you will.
Well, do you think, too, we talked a little before the broadcast, I said how committed I was to print, and I work in print. And you can say this quite frankly, is that just dinosaurism? Is it maybe if I can, and my friends can keep this magazine going for a few more years, but ultimately there's not going to be any more ink on paper anymore. I hope that's not the case, but what do you think, Rory O'Connor?
Well, there will always be, ink on paper, just as, there's always been opera. But I think where you're going to find opera, for example, when it was created, was a mass medium.
Yeah.
Ordinary people would go and in the pits, right? And then over time, it moved to the point where it was really only for the elite. And I think that you're probably going to see something similar happening with print, But one of the messages that, and I want to reiterate this here, because there's so much doom and gloom out there. The newspapers are laying people off. The magazines are going out of business. Since they're the messenger, as well as the victims, if you will, they're creating a narrative. They're reporting, that journalism is dying. My point is, no, journalism isn't dying. Newspapers may well be dying, but journalism actually has the potential to thrive now in a way that it hasn't almost since its inception. So I think it's a very exciting and promising time to be a young person. In particular, the barriers to entry into the journalism field are lower than they've ever been before. There's a tremendous amount of experimentation going on. A lot of it is technological and in an area where the young people actually have an advantage, you know, over the people who are, you know, now sitting in the media, and people are looking, you know, to them to take the lead. So I try to counter that doom and gloom narrative that the newspapers are delivering, because, yes, it's doom and gloom for newspapers, but not necessarily for journalism.
Well, Rory O'Connor, I want to thank you so much. The book is both informative and challenging to people like me. It's called Friends, Followers, and the Future, How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media. Rory O'Connor, you can go to actually his website, just his name.org. And Rory O'Connor is a writer, filmmaker, and journalist. He is he blogs for sites like Huffington Post, Alternet, and his own media is a plural. And if you can hook up to all of it, including the book, at RoryO'Connor.org. And not to be forgotten, it's published by City Lights, an incredible publisher, CityLights.com. Oh, by the way, and I'll have a link on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Rory O'Connor, thanks for being on the broadcast.
My pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Listen to win tickets to see Kid Rock with the DSO May 12th at the Box. Details online at WRIF.com.